This is Audible.
Poirot's Early Cases by Agatha Christie. Read by David Suchet. The Plymouth Express. Alec Simpson, R.N., stepped from the platform at Newton Abbot into a first-class compartment of the Plymouth Express. A porter followed him with a heavy suitcase. He was about to swing it up to the rack, but the young sailor stopped him. Leave it on the seat. I'll put it up later. Here you are.
Oh, thank you, sir.
The porter, generously tipped, withdrew. Doors banged. A stentorian voice shouted,
Plymouth only! Change for Torquay! Plymouth next stop!
Then a whistle blew, and the train drew slowly out of the station. Lieutenant Simpson had the carriage to himself. The December air was chilly, and he pulled up the window. Then he sniffed vaguely and frowned. What a smell there was! Reminded him of that time in hospital and the operation on his leg. Oh yes, chloroform. That was it. He let the window down again, changing his seat to one with its back to the engine. He pulled a pipe out of his pocket and lit it. For a little time he sat inactive, looking out into the night and smoking. At last, he roused himself, and opening the suitcase, took out some papers and magazines, then closed the suitcase again and endeavoured to shove it under the opposite seat, without success. Some obstacle resisted it. He shoved harder with rising impatience, but it still stuck out halfway into the carriage. Why the devil won't it go in? He muttered, and hauling it out completely, he stooped down and peered under the seat. A moment later, a cry rang out into the night, and the great train came to an unwilling halt in obedience to the imperative jerking of the communication cord.
Mon ami, said Poirot, you have, I know, been deeply interested in this mystery of the Plymouth Express. Read this.
I picked up the note he flicked across the table to me. It was brief and to the point. Dear sir, I shall be obliged if you will call upon me at your earliest convenience. Yours faithfully, Ebenezer Halliday. The connection was not clear to my mind, and I looked inquiringly at Poirot. For an answer, he took up the newspaper and read aloud.
A sensational discovery was made last night. A young naval officer returning to Plymouth found under the seat of his compartment the body of a woman stabbed through the heart. The officer at once pulled the communication cord and the train was brought to a standstill. The woman, who was about 30 years of age and richly dressed, has not yet been identified. And later we have this. The woman found dead in the Plymouth Express has been identified as the Honourable Mrs. Rupert Carrington. You see now, my friend? Or if you do not, I will add this. Mrs. Rupert Carrington was, before her marriage, Flossie Halliday, daughter of Old Man Halliday, the Steel King of America.
Well, and he has sent for you? Splendid!
I did him a little service in the past, an affair of bearer bonds, and once when I was in Paris for a royal visit I had Mademoiselle Flossie pointed out to me, la jolie petite pensionnaire. She had the jolie dot, too. It caused trouble. She nearly made a bad affair.
Oh, how was that?
A certain Count de la Rochefort, un bien mauvais sujet, a bad hat, as you would say. An adventurer pure and simple who knew how to appeal to a romantic young girl. Luckily, her father got wind of it in time. He took her back to America in haste. I heard of her marriage some years later, but I know nothing of her husband.
I said. The Honourable Rupert Carrington is no beauty by all accounts. He had pretty well run through his own money on the turf, and I should imagine Old Man Halliday's dollars came along in the nick of time. I should say that for a good-looking, well-mannered, utterly unscrupulous young scoundrel, it would be hard to find his mate.
The poor little lady, elle n'est pas bien tombée. I fancy he made it pretty obvious at once that it was her money and not she that attracted him. I believe they drifted apart almost at once. I have heard rumours lately that there was to be a definite legal separation.
Well,
Old Man Halliday is no fool. He would tie up her money pretty tight.
Yes, I dare say. Anyway, I know as a fact that the Honourable Rupert is said to be extremely hard up.
I wonder.
Oh, you wonder what?
My good friend, do not jump down my throat like that. You are interested, I see. Suppose you accompany me to see Mr. Halliday. There is a taxi stand at the corner.
A few minutes sufficed to whirl us to the superb house in Park Lane rented by the American magnate. We were shown into the library, and almost immediately we were joined by a large, stout man with piercing eyes and an aggressive chin.
Monsieur Poirot, said Mr. Halliday, I guess I don't need to tell you what I want you for. You've read the papers, and I'm never one to let the grass grow under my feet. I happened to hear you were in London, and I remembered the good work you did over those bonds. I never forget a name. I have got the pick of Scotland Yard, but I'll have my own man as well. Money no object. All the dollars were made for my little girl, and now she's gone. I'll spend my last cent to catch the damn scoundrel that did it.
See?
So it's up to you to deliver the goods.
Poirot bowed. I accept, monsieur. Or the more willingly that I saw your daughter in Paris several times. And now I will ask you to tell me the circumstances of her journey to Plymouth and any other details that seem to you to bear upon the case.
Well, to begin with, responded Halliday, she wasn't going to Plymouth. She was going to join a house party at Avonmead Court, the Duchess of Swansea's place. She left London by the 12:14 from Paddington, arriving at Bristol, where she had to change, at 2:50. The principal Plymouth expresses, of course, run via Westbury and do not go near Bristol at all. The 12:14 does a non-stop run to Bristol, afterwards stopping at Weston, Taunton, Exeter, and Newton Abbot. My daughter travelled alone in her carriage, which was reserved as far as Bristol, her maid being in a third-class carriage in the next coach. Poirot nodded, and Mr. Halliday went on. The party at Avonmead Court was to be a very gay one, with several balls. And in consequence, my daughter had with her nearly all her jewels, amounting in value perhaps to about $100,000.
Au moment, interrupted Poirot. Who had charge of the jewels, your daughter or the maid?
My daughter always took charge of them herself, carrying them in a small blue Morocco case.
Continue, monsieur.
At Bristol, the maid, Jane Mason, collected her mistress's dressing bag and wraps, which were with her, and came to the door of Flossie's compartment. To her intense surprise, my daughter told her that she was not getting out of Bristol, but was going on farther. She directed Mason to get out the luggage and put it in the cloakroom. She could have tea in the refreshment room, but she was to wait at the station for her mistress, who would return to Bristol by an up train in the course of the afternoon. The maid, although very much astonished, did as she was told. She put the luggage in the cloakroom and had some tea. But up train after up train came in, and her mistress did not appear. After the arrival of the last train, she left the luggage where it was and went to a hotel near the station for the night. This morning, she read of the tragedy and returned to town by the first available train.
Is there nothing to account for your daughter's sudden change of plan?
Well, there is this. According to Jane Mason at Bristol, Flossie was no longer alone in her carriage. There was a man in it who stood looking out of the farther window so that she could not see his face.
The train was a corridor one, of course?
Yes.
Which side was the corridor?
On the platform side. My daughter was standing in the corridor as she talked to Mason.
And there is no doubt in your mind? Oh, excuse me.
He got up and carefully straightened the inkstand, which was a little askew.
Je vous demande pardon, he continued, reseating himself. It affects my nerves to see anything crooked. Strange, is it not? As I was saying, monsieur, there is no doubt in your mind as to this probably unexpected meeting because the cause of your daughter's sudden change of plan?
Well, it seems the only reasonable supposition.
And you have no idea as to who the gentleman in question might be?
The millionaire hesitated for a moment and then replied, No, I do not know at all.
Now, as to the discovery of the body?
Well, it was discovered by a young naval officer who at once gave the alarm. There was a doctor on the train. He examined the body. She had been first chloroformed and then stabbed. He gave it as his opinion that she had been dead about 4 hours, so it must have been done not long after leaving Bristol, probably between there and Weston, possibly between Weston and Taunton.
And the jewel case?
The jewel case, Monsieur Poirot, was missing.
One thing more, monsieur. Your daughter's fortune, to whom does it pass at her death?
Flossie made a will soon after her marriage, leaving everything to her husband. He hesitated for a minute and then went on. I may as well tell you, Monsieur Poirot, that I regard my son-in-law as an unprincipled scoundrel, and that by my advice my daughter was on the eve of freeing herself from him by legal means. No difficult matter. I settled her money upon her in such a way that he could not touch it during her lifetime, but although they have lived entirely apart for some years, she had frequently acceded to his demands for money rather than face an open scandal. However, I was determined to put an end to this. At last, Flossie agreed, and my lawyers were instructed to take proceedings.
And where is Monsieur Carrington?
In town. I believe he was away in the country yesterday, but he returned last night. Poirot considered a little while. Then he said,
I think that is all, monsieur.
You'd like to see the maid, Jane Mason?
If you please.
Halliday rang the bell and gave a short order to the footman. A few minutes later, Jane Mason entered the room. A respectable, hard-featured woman, as emotionless in the face of tragedy as only a good servant can be.
You will permit me to put a few questions? Your mistress, she was quite as usual before starting yesterday morning, not excited or flurried? Oh, no, sir. But at Bristol, she was quite different? Yes, sir, regular upset. So nervous she didn't seem to know what she was saying. What did she say exactly?
Well, sir, as near as I can remember, she said, Mason, I've got to alter my plans. Something has happened. I mean, I'm not getting out here after all. I must go on. Get the luggage and put it in the cloakroom, then have some tea and wait for me in the station. Wait for you here, ma'am? I asked. Yes, yes, don't leave the station. I shall return by a later train. I don't know when, it mayn't be until quite late. Very well, ma'am, I says. Well, it wasn't my place to ask questions, but I thought it very strange.
It was unlike your mistress, eh?
Very unlike her, sir.
What did you think?
Well, sir, I thought it was to do with the gentleman in the carriage. She didn't speak to him, but she turned round once or twice as though to ask him if she was doing right.
But you did not see the gentleman's face?
No, sir. He stood with his back to me all the time.
Can you describe him at all?
He had on a light fawn overcoat and a travelling cap. He was tall and slender-like, and the back of his head was dark.
You didn't know him?
Oh, no, I don't think so, sir.
It was not your master, Mr. Carrington, by any chance?
Mason looked rather startled.
Oh, I don't think so, sir.
But you are not sure?
It was about the master's build, sir, but I never thought of it being him. We so seldom saw him. I couldn't say it wasn't him.
Poirot picked up a pin from the carpet and frowned at it severely. Then he continued,
Would it be possible for the man to have entered the train at Bristol before you reached the carriage?
Mason considered.
Yes, sir, I think it would. My compartment was very crowded, and it was some minutes before I could get out, and then there was a very large crowd on the platform, and that delayed me too. But he'd only have had a minute or two to speak to the mistress that way. I took it for granted that he'd come along the corridor.
That is more probable, certainly.
He paused, still frowning.
You know how the mistress was dressed, sir? The papers give a few details, but I would like you to confirm them.
She was wearing a white fox fur toque, sir, with a white spotted veil and a blue frieze coat and skirt, the shade of blue they call electric.
Rather striking.
Yeah, remarked Mr. Halliday. Inspector Japp is in hopes that that may help us to fix the spot where the crime took place. Anyone who saw her would remember her.
Précisément. Thank you, mademoiselle.
The maid left the room.
Well, Poirot got up briskly. That is all I can do here, except, monsieur, that I would ask you to tell me everything, but everything.
Why, I've done so.
You are sure?
Absolutely.
Then there is nothing more to be said. I must decline the case.
Why?
Because you have not been frank with me.
I assure you...
No, you are keeping something back.
There was a moment's pause, and then Halliday drew a paper from his pocket and handed it to my friend. "I guess that's what you're after, Monsieur Poirot, though how you know about it fairly gets my goat." Poirot smiled and unfolded the paper. It was a letter written in thin, sloping handwriting. Poirot read it aloud.
"Cher Madame, it is with infinite pleasure that I look forward to the felicity of meeting you again. After your so amiable reply to my letter, I can hardly restrain my impatience. I have never forgotten those days in Paris. It is most cruel that you should be leaving London tomorrow. However, before very long, and perhaps sooner than you think, I shall have the joy of beholding once more the lady whose image has ever reigned supreme in my heart. Believe, cher madame, all the assurances of my most devoted and unaltered sentiments, Armand de la Rochefort."
Poirot handed the letter back to Halliday with a bow.
"I fancy, monsieur, that you did not know that your daughter intended renewing her acquaintance with the Count de la Rochefort?"
"It came as a thunderbolt to me. I found this letter in my daughter's handbag. As you probably know, Monsieur Poirot, this so-called Count is an adventurer of the worst type." Poirot nodded. "But I want to know how you knew of the existence of this letter." My friend smiled.
"Monsieur, I did not. But to track footmarks and recognize cigarette ash is not sufficient for a detective. He must also be a good psychologist. I knew that you disliked and mistrusted your son-in-law. He benefits by your daughter's death. The maid's description of the mysterious man bears a sufficient resemblance to him. Yet you are not keen on his track. Why? Surely because your suspicions lie in another direction. Therefore, you are keeping something back."
"You're right, Monsieur Poirot. I was sure of Rupert's guilt until I found this letter. It unsettled me horribly."
"Yes, the Count says, before very long, and perhaps sooner than you think. Obviously, he would not want to wait until you should get wind of his reappearance. Was it he who travelled down from London by the 12:14 and came along the corridor to your daughter's compartment? The Count de la Rochefort is also, if I remember rightly, tall and dark."
The millionaire nodded. "Well, monsieur, I will wish you good day. Scotland Yard has, I presume, a list of the jewels?"
Yes. And I believe Inspector Japp of Scotland Yard is here now, if you would like to see him."
Japp was an old friend of ours and greeted Poirot with a sort of affectionate contempt.
"And how are you, monsieur? No bad feeling between us, though we have got our different ways of looking at things. How are the little grey cells, eh? Going strong?"
Poirot beamed upon him.
"They function, my good Japp. Assuredly they do."
"Well, then that's all right. Think it was the Honourable Rupert or the Crook? We're keeping an eye on all the regular places, of course. We shall know if the shiners are disposed of. And, of course, whoever did it isn't going to keep them to admire their sparkle. Not likely. I'm trying to find out where Rupert Carrington was yesterday. Seems a bit of a mystery about it. I've got a man watching him."
A great precaution, but perhaps a day late," suggested Poirot gently.
"You always will have your joke, Monsieur Poirot. Well, I'm off to Paddington, Bristol, Weston, Taunton. That's my beat. So long."
"You will come round and see me this evening and tell me the result?"
"Oh, sure thing, if I'm back."
"That good inspector believes in matter in motion," murmured Poirot as our friend departed. "He travels, he measures footprints, he collects mud and cigarette ash. He is extremely busy. He is zealous beyond words, and if I mentioned psychology to him, do you know what he would do, my friend? He would smile. He would say to himself, 'Poor old Poirot, he ages, he grows senile.' Japp is the younger generation knocking at the door, and ma foi, they are so busy knocking that they do not notice that the door is open."
"Now, what are you going to do?"
"Well, as we have carte blanche, I shall expend 3 pence in ringing up the Ritz, where you may have noticed our Count is staying. After that, as my feet are a little damp and I have sneezed twice, I shall return to my rooms and make myself a tisane over the spirit lamp."
I did not see Poirot again until the following morning. I found him placidly finishing his breakfast. Well, I inquired eagerly, what's happened?
Nothing.
But Jap?
I have not seen him.
The Count?
He left our Ritz the day before yesterday.
Well, the day of the murder?
Yes.
Well, then that settles it. Rupert Carrington is cleared.
But because the Count de la Rochefort has left our Ritz? No, no. You go too fast, my friend.
Well, anyway, he must be followed, arrested. But what could be his motive?
$100,000 worth of jewellery is a very good motive for anyone. No. The question to my mind is, why kill her? Why not simply steal the jewels? She would not prosecute.
Well, why not?
Because she is a woman, mon ami. She once loved this man. Therefore, she would suffer her loss in silence. And the Count, who is an extremely good psychologist where women are concerned, hence his successes, would know that perfectly well. On the other hand, if Rupert Carrington killed her, why take the jewels which would incriminate him fatally?
Well, as a blind.
Well, perhaps you are right, my friend.
Ah,
here is Jap. I recognize his knock.
The inspector was beaming good-humouredly. Morning, Poirot. Only just got back. I've done some good work. And you?
Me? I have arranged my ideas, replied Poirot placidly.
Jap laughed heartily. Old chap's getting on in years, he observed beneath his breath to me. That won't do for us young folk, he said aloud.
Quel dommage,
Poirot inquired. Well, do you want to hear what I've done?
You permit me to make a guess? You have found the knife with which the crime was committed by the side of the line between Weston and Taunton, and you have interviewed the paper boy who spoke to Mrs. Carrington at Weston.
Jap's jaw fell.
How on earth did you know? Don't tell me it was those almighty little grey cells of yours.
I am glad you admit for once that they are almighty. Tell me, did she give the paper boy a shilling for himself?
No, it was half a crown. Jap had recovered his temper and grinned. Pretty extravagant, these rich Americans.
And in consequence, the boy did not forget her?
No, not he. Half-crowns don't come his way every day. She hailed him and bought two magazines. One had a picture of a girl in blue on the cover. Huh, that'll match me, she said. Oh, he remembered her perfectly. Well, that was enough for me. By the doctor's evidence, the crime must have been committed before Taunton. I guess they'd throw the knife away at once, and I walked down the line looking for it, and sure enough, there it was. I made inquiries at Taunton about our man, but of course it's a big station. It wasn't likely they'd notice him. He probably got back to London by a later train. Poirot nodded.
Very likely.
But I found another bit of news when I got back. They're passing the jewels, all right. That large emerald was pawned last night by one of the regular lot.
Who do you think it was?
I don't know. Except that he was a short man.
Jap stared. Well, yeah, you're right there. He's short enough.
It was Red Narky.
Well,
who is Red Narky?
I asked. Well, a particular sharp jewel thief, sir, and not one to stick at murder. Usually works with a woman, Gracie Kidd. But she doesn't seem to be in it this time, unless she's got off to Holland with the rest of the swag.
What, you've arrested Narky?
Yeah, sure thing, but mind you, it's the other man we want, the man who went down with Mrs. Carrington in the train. He's the one who planned the job right enough, but Narky won't squeal on a pal.
I noticed that Poirot's eyes had become very green.
I think, he said gently, that I can find Narky's pal for you, all right?
One of your little ideas, eh? Jap eyed Poirot sharply. Wonderful how you manage to deliver the goods sometimes at your age and all. Devil's own luck, of course.
Perhaps. Perhaps,
murmured my friend.
Hastings, my hat. And the brush? So, my galoshes, if it still rains. We must not undo the good work of that Tissan. Au revoir, Jap.
Well, good luck to you, Poirot.
Poirot hailed the first taxi we met and directed the driver to Park Lane. When we drew up before Halliday's house, he skipped out nimbly, paid the driver and rang the bell. To the footman who opened the door, he made a request in a low voice, and we were immediately taken upstairs. We went up to the top of the house and were shown into a small, neat bedroom. Poirot's eyes roved round the room and fastened themselves on a small black trunk.
He knelt in front of it, scrutinised the labels on it, and took a small twist of wire from his pocket.
"Ask Mr. Halliday if you will be so kind as to mount to me here," he said over his shoulder to the footman.
The man departed, and Poirot gently coaxed the lock of the trunk with a practised hand. In a few minutes the lock gave, and he raised the lid of the trunk. Swiftly he began rummaging among the clothes it contained, flinging them out on the floor. There was a heavy step on the stairs, and Halliday entered the room.
"What in the hell are you doing here?" he demanded, staring.
"I was looking, monsieur, for this."
Poirot withdrew from the trunk a coat and skirt of bright blue frieze and a small toque of white fox fur.
"What are you doing with my trunk?"
I turned to see that the maid, Jane Mason, had entered the room.
"If you will just shut the door, Hastings."
"Thank you.
Yes, and stand with your back against it. Now, Mr. Halliday, let me introduce you to Gracie Kidd, otherwise Jane Mason, who will shortly rejoin her accomplice, Red Naki, under the kind escort of Inspector Japp."
Poirot waved a deprecating hand.
"It was of the most simple."
He helped himself to more caviar.
"It was the maid's insistence on the clothes that her mistress was wearing that first struck me. Why was she so anxious that our attention should be directed to them? I reflected that we had only the maid's word for the mysterious man in the carriage at Bristol. As far as the doctor's evidence went, Mrs. Carrington might easily have been murdered before reaching Bristol. But if so, then the maid must be an accomplice. And if she were an accomplice, she would not wish this point to rest on her evidence alone. The clothes Mrs. Carrington were wearing were of a striking nature. A maid usually has a good deal of choice as to what her mistress shall wear. Now, if after Bristol anyone saw a lady in a bright blue coat and skirt and a fur toque, he will be quite ready to swear he had seen Mrs. Carrington. I began to reconstruct. The maid would provide herself with duplicate clothes. She and her accomplice chloroform and stab Mrs. Carrington between London and Bristol, probably taking advantage of a tunnel. Her body is rolled under the seat, and the maid takes her place. At Weston, she must make herself noticed. How? In all probability, a newspaper boy will be selected. She will ensure he's remembering her by giving him a large tip. She also draws his attention to the colour of her dress by a remark about one of the magazines. After leaving Weston, she throws the knife out of the window to mark the place where the crime presumably occurred and changes her clothes or buttons a long mackintosh over them. At Taunton, she leaves the train and returns to Bristol as soon as possible, where her accomplice has duly left the luggage in the cloakroom. He hands over the ticket and himself returns to London. She waits on the platform, carrying out her role, goes to a hotel for the night, and returns to town in the morning exactly as she said. When Japp returned from this expedition, he confirmed all my deductions. He also told me that a well-known crook was passing the jewels. I knew that whoever it was would be the exact opposite of the man Jane Mason described. When I heard that it was Red Naki, who always worked with Gracie Kidd, well, I knew just where to find her.
And the Count?
The more I thought of it, the more I was convinced that he had nothing to do with it. That gentleman is much too careful of his own skin to risk murder. It would be out of keeping with his character.
Well, Monsieur Poirot, said Halliday, I owe you a big debt. And the check I write after lunch won't go near to settling it. Poirot smiled modestly and murmured to me,
The good Jap. He shall get the official credit, all right, but though he has got his Gracie Kidd, I think that I, as the Americans say, have got his goat.
The submarine plans. A note had been brought by special messenger. Poirot read it, and a gleam of excitement and interest came into his eyes as he did so. He dismissed the man with a few curt words and then turned to me.
Pack a bag with all haste, my friend. We are going down to Shapples.
I started at the mention of the famous country place of Lord Alloway. Head of the newly formed Ministry of Defence, Lord Alloway was a prominent member of the Cabinet. As Sir Ralph Curtis, head of a great engineering firm, he had made his mark in the House of Commons, and he was now freely spoken of as the coming man, and the one most likely to be asked to form a ministry should the rumours as to Mr. David McAdam's health prove well-founded. A big Rolls-Royce car was waiting for us below, and as we glided off into the darkness, I plied Poirot with questions. "What on earth can they want us for at this time of night?" I demanded. It was past 11. Poirot shook his head. "Something of the most urgent, without doubt." "I remember," I said, "that some years ago there was some rather ugly scandal about Ralph Curtis, as he then was. Some jugglery with shares, I believe. In the end, he was completely exonerated, but perhaps something of the kind has arisen again."
"It would hardly be necessary for him to send for me in the middle of the night, my friend."
I was forced to agree, and the remainder of the journey was passed in silence. Once out of London, the powerful car forged rapidly ahead, and we arrived at Sharples in a little under the hour. A pontifical butler conducted us at once to a small study where Lord Alloway was awaiting us. He sprang up to greet us, a tall, spare man who seemed actually to radiate power and vitality.
"Oh, Monsieur Poirot, I'm delighted to see you. It's the second time the government has demanded your services. I remember only too well what you did for us during the war, when the Prime Minister was kidnapped in that astounding fashion. Your masterly deductions, and may I add your discretion, saved the situation."
Poirot's eyes twinkled a little.
"Do I gather then, Milor, that this is another case for discretion?"
"Most emphatically. Sir Harry and I... Oh, let me introduce you. Admiral Sir Harry Weardale, our first Sea Lord, Monsieur Poirot, and, let me see, Captain, Hastings," I supplied.
"I've often heard of you, Monsieur Poirot," said Sir Harry, shaking hands. "This is a most unaccountable business, and if you can solve it, we'll be extremely grateful to you."
I liked the first Sea Lord immediately, a square bluff sailor of the good old-fashioned type.
Poirot looked inquiringly at them both, and Alloway took up the tale.
"Of course you understand that all this is in confidence, Monsieur Poirot. We have had a most serious loss. The plans of the new Z-type of submarine have been stolen."
"When was that?"
"Tonight. Less than 3 hours ago. You can appreciate, perhaps, Monsieur Poirot, the magnitude of the disaster. It is essential that the loss should not be made public. I will give you the facts as briefly as possible. My guests over the weekend were the Admiral here, his wife and son, and a Mrs. Conrad, a lady well known in London society. The ladies retired to bed early, about 10 o'clock. So did Mr. Leonard Weardale. Sir Harry is down here partly for the purpose of discussing the construction of this new type of submarine with me. Accordingly, I asked Mr. Fitzroy, my secretary, to get out the plans from the safe in the corner there and to arrange them ready for me, as well as various other documents that bore upon the subject in hand. While he was doing this, the Admiral and I strolled up and down the terrace smoking cigars and enjoying the warm June air. We finished our smoke and our chat and decided to get down to business. Just as we turned at the far end of the terrace, I fancied I saw a shadow slip out of the French window here, cross the terrace and disappear. I paid very little attention, however. I knew Fitzroy to be in this room, and it never entered my head that anything might be amiss. There, of course, I am to blame. Well, we retraced our steps along the terrace and entered this room by the window just as Fitzroy entered from the hall. "Got everything out we're likely to need, Fitzroy?" I asked. "I think so, Lord Alloway. Papers are all on your desk," he answered. And then he wished us both good night. "Now, just wait a minute," I said, going to the desk. I may want something I haven't mentioned." I looked quickly through the papers that were lying there. "Well, oh, you've forgotten the most important of the lot, Fitzroy," I said. "The actual plans of the submarine." "But the plans are right on the top, Lord Alloway." "Oh, no, they're not," I said, turning over the papers. "But I put them there not a minute ago." "Well, they're not there now," I said. Fitzroy advanced with a bewildered expression on his face, and the thing seemed incredible. We turned over the papers on the desk, we hunted through the safe, but at last we had to make up our minds to it that the papers were gone. And gone within the short space of about 3 minutes while Fitzroy was absent from the room.
"Why did he leave the room?"
asked Poirot quickly.
"Well, that's just what I asked him," exclaimed Sir Harry. "It appears," said Lord Alloway, "that just when he had finished arranging the papers on my desk, he was startled by hearing a woman scream. He dashed out into the hall. On the stairs, he discovered Mrs. Conrad's French maid. The girl looked very white and upset and declared that she had seen a ghost, a tall figure dressed all in white, that moved without a sound. Fitzroy laughed at her fears and told her, in more or less polite language, not to be a fool. Then he returned to this room just as we entered from the window."
"But yours seems very clear," said Poirot thoughtfully. "The only question is, was the maid an accomplice? Did she scream by arrangement with her confederate lurking outside, or was he merely waiting there in the hope of an opportunity presenting itself? It was a man, I suppose, not a woman you saw?"
"Well, I can't tell you, Monsieur Poirot. It was just a shadow."
The Admiral gave such a peculiar snort that it could not fail to attract attention.
"Monsieur l'Amiral has something to say, I think," said Poirot quietly, with a slight smile. "You saw this shadow, Sir Harry?"
No, I didn't," returned the other, "and neither did Alloway. The branch of a tree flapped or something, and then afterwards, when we discovered the theft, he leapt to the conclusion that he had seen someone pass across the terrace. His imagination played a trick on him, that's all."
"I am not usually credited with having much imagination," said Lord Alloway, with a slight smile.
"Nonsense. We've all got imagination. We can all work ourselves out to believe that we've seen more than we have. I've had a lifetime experience at sea, and I'll back my eyes against those of any landsman. I was looking right down the terrace, and I'd have seen the same if there was anything to see."
He was quite excited over the matter. Poirot rose and stepped quickly to the window.
"You permit?" he asked. "We must settle this point, if possible."
He went out upon the terrace, and we followed him. He had taken an electric torch from his pocket and was playing light along the edge of the grass that bordered the terrace.
"Where did he cross the terrace, Milor?" he asked.
"About opposite the window, I should say."
Poirot continued to play the torch for some minutes longer, walking the entire length of the terrace and back. Then he shut it off and straightened himself up.
"Sir Harry is right and you are wrong, Milor," he said quietly. "It rained heavily earlier this evening. Anyone who passed over that grass could not avoid leaving footmarks. But there are none. None at all."
His eyes went from one man's face to the other's. Lord Alloway looked bewildered and unconvinced. The Admiral expressed a noisy gratification.
"Knew I couldn't be wrong," he declared. "Trust my eyes anywhere."
He was such a picture of an honest old sea dog that I could not help smiling.
"So that brings us to the people in the house," said Poirot smoothly. "Let us come inside again. Now, Milor, while Mr. Fitzroy was speaking to the maid on the stairs, could anyone have seized the opportunity to enter the study from the hall?"
Lord Alloway shook his head. "Oh, quite impossible. They would have had to pass him in order to do so."
"And Mr. Fitzroy himself, you are sure of him, eh?"
Lord Alloway flushed.
"Oh, absolutely, Monsieur Poirot. I will answer confidently for my secretary. It's quite impossible that he should be concerned in the matter in any way."
"Everything seems to be impossible," remarked Poirot rather dryly. "Possibly the plans attached to themselves a little pair of wings and flew away. Comme ça."
He blew his lips out like a comical cherub.
"The whole thing is impossible," declared Lord Alloway impatiently. "But I beg, Monsieur Poirot, that you will not dream of suspecting Fitzroy. Consider for one moment, had he wished to take the plans, what could have been easier for him than to take a tracing of them without going to the trouble of stealing them?"
"There, Milor," said Poirot with approval, "you make a remark bien juste. I see that you have a mind orderly and methodical. L'Angleterre is happy in possessing you."
Lord Alloway looked rather embarrassed by this sudden burst of praise. Poirot returned to the matter in hand.
"The room in which you had been sitting all the evening?"
"The drawing room, yes."
"Well, that also has a window on the terrace. Since I remember your saying you went out that way, would it not be possible for someone to come out by the drawing room window and in by this one while Mr. Fitzroy was out of the room and return the same way?"
"Ah, but we'd have seen them," objected the Admiral.
"Not if you had your back turned, walking the other way."
"Well, Fitzroy was only out of the room a few minutes. The time it would take us to walk to the end and back."
"No matter, it is a possibility. In fact, the only one, as things stand."
"But there was no one in the drawing room when we went out," said the Admiral.
"They may have come there afterwards."
You mean, said Lord Alloway slowly, that when Fitzroy heard the maid scream and went out, someone was already concealed in the drawing-room, and that they darted in and out through the windows, and only left the drawing-room when Fitzroy had returned to this room?
The methodical mind again, said Poirot, bowing. You express the matter perfectly.
One of the servants, perhaps.
Or a guest? It was Mrs. Conrad's maid who screamed. What exactly can you tell me of Mrs. Conrad?
Lord Alloway considered for a minute. I told you that she is a lady well known in society. That is true in the sense that she gives large parties and goes everywhere, but very little is known as to where she really comes from and what her past life has been. She is a lady who frequents diplomatic and foreign office circles as much as possible. The Secret Service is inclined to ask why.
I see,
said Poirot.
And she was asked here this weekend?
So that, shall we say, we might observe her at close quarters.
Parfaitement. It is possible that she has turned the tables on you rather neatly.
Lord Alloway looked discomfited, and Poirot continued.
Tell me, milord, was any reference made in her hearing to the subjects you and the Admiral were going to discuss together?
Oh, yes, admitted the other. Sir Harry said, and now for our submarine to work, or something of that sort. The others had left the room, but she had come back for a book.
I see, said Poirot thoughtfully. Milord, it is very late, but this is an urgent affair. I would like to question the members of this house party at once, if it is possible.
It can be managed, of course, said Lord Alloway. The awkward thing is we don't want to let it get about more than can be helped. Of course, Lady Juliet Weardale and young Leonard are all right, but Mrs. Conrad, if she's not guilty, is rather a different proposition. Perhaps you could just state that an important paper is missing, without specifying what it is or going into any of the circumstances of the disappearance.
Exactly what I was about to propose myself, said Poirot, beaming. In fact, in all three cases. Monsieur, the Admiral will pardon me, but even the best of wives...
Oh, no offence, said Sir Harry. All women talk, bless 'em. I wish Juliet would talk a little more and play bridge a little less. But women are like that nowadays, never happy unless they're dancing or gambling. I'll get Juliet and Leonard up, shall I, Alloway?
Oh, thank you. I'll call the French maid. Monsieur Poirot will want to see her, and she can rouse her mistress. I'll attend to it now. In the meantime, I'll send Fitzroy along.
Mr. Fitzroy was a pale, thin young man with pince-nez and a frigid expression. His statement was practically word for word what Lord Alloway had already told us.
But what is your own theory, Mr. Fitzroy?
Mr. Fitzroy shrugged his shoulders. Well, undoubtedly, someone who knew the hang of things was waiting his chance outside. He could see what went on through the window, and he slipped in when I left the room. It's a pity Lord Alloway didn't give chase then and there when he saw the fellow leave. Poirot did not undeceive him. Instead, he asked,
Do you believe the story of the French maid, that she had seen a ghost?
Well, hardly, Monsieur Poirot.
I mean that she really thought so.
Well, as to that, I can't say. She certainly seemed rather upset. She had her hands to her head.
Aha,
cried Poirot, with the air of one who has made a discovery.
Is that so indeed? And she was without doubt a pretty girl?
But I didn't notice particularly, said Mr. Fitzroy in a repressive voice.
You did not see her mistress, I suppose?
Well, as a matter of fact, I did. She was in the gallery at the top of the stairs and was calling her, Leone. And then she saw me, and of course retired.
Upstairs? Said Poirot, frowning.
Of course, I realise all this has been very unpleasant for me, or rather would have been if Lord Alloway had not chanced to see the man actually leaving. In any case, I should be glad if you would make a point of searching my room and myself.
You really wish that?
Oh, certainly I do. What Poirot would have replied, I do not know, but at that moment Lord Alloway reappeared and informed us that the two ladies and Mr. Leonard Weardale were in the drawing-room. The women were in becoming negligee. Mrs. Conrad was a beautiful woman of 35 with golden hair and a slight tendency to embonpoint. Lady Juliet Weardale must have been 40, tall and dark, very thin, still beautiful, with exquisite hands and feet, and a restless, haggard manner. Her son was rather an effeminate-looking young man, as great a contrast to his bluff, hearty father as could well be imagined. Poirot gave forth the little rigmarole we had agreed upon, and then explained that he was anxious to know if anyone had heard or seen anything that night which might assist us. Turning to Mrs. Conrad first, he asked her if she would be so kind as to inform him exactly what her movements had been.
Let me see. I went upstairs, I rang for my maid. Then, as she did not put in an appearance, I came out and called her. I could hear her talking on the stairs. After she had brushed my hair, I sent her away. She was in a very curious, nervous state. I read a while and then went to bed. And you, Lady Juliet? Oh, I went straight upstairs and to bed. I was very tired.
What about your book, dear? Asked Mrs. Conrad with a sweet smile.
My book?
Lady Juliet flushed.
Yes, you know, when I sent Leonie away, you were coming up the stairs. You'd been down to the drawing room for a book, you said.
Oh, yes, I did go down. I forgot. Lady Juliet clasped her hands nervously together.
Did you hear Mrs. Conrad's maid scream, my lady?
No, I didn't. How curious.
Because you must have been in the drawing room at that time.
But I heard nothing,
said Lady Juliet in a firmer voice. Poirot turned to young Leonard.
Monsieur?
Nothing doing. I went straight upstairs and turned in.
Poirot stroked his chin.
Alas, I fear there is nothing to help me here. Mesdames and messieurs, I regret infinitely to have deranged you from your slumbers for so little. Accept my apologies, I pray of you.
Gesticulating and apologizing, he marshalled them out. He returned with the French maid, a pretty, impudent-looking girl. Alloway and Weardale had gone out with the ladies.
"Now, mademoiselle," said Poirot in a brisk tone, "let us have the truth. Recount to me no histories. Why did you scream on the stairs?"
"Ah, monsieur, I saw a tall figure, all in white."
Poirot arrested her with an energetic shake of his forefinger.
"Did I not say recount to me no histories? I will make a guess. He kissed you, did he not? Monsieur Leonard Weardale, I mean."
"Eh bien, monsieur, and after all, what is a kiss?"
"Under the circumstances, it is most natural," replied Poirot gallantly. "I, myself, or Hastings here? But tell me just what occurred."
"He came up behind me and caught me. I was startled and I screamed. If I had known, I would not have screamed, but he came upon me like a cat. Then came Monsieur le Secrétaire. Monsieur Leonard flew up the stairs, and what could I say? Especially to a jeune homme comme ça, tellement comme il faut. Ma foi, I invent a ghost."
"And all is explained," cried Poirot genially. "You then mounted to the chamber of Madame your mistress. Which is her room, by the way?"
"It is at the end, monsieur, that way."
"Ah, directly over the study, then. Bien, mademoiselle, I will detain you no longer. And la prochaine fois, do not scream."
Handing her out, he came back to me with a smile.
"An interesting case, is it not, Hastings? I begin to have a few little ideas."
"Et vous?"
"What was Leonard Weardale doing on the stairs? I don't like that young man, Poirot. He's a thorough young rake, I should say."
"I agree with you, mon ami."
"Well, Fitzroy seems an honest fellow."
"Lord Alloway is certainly insistent on that point.
And yet there's something in his manner
that is almost too good to be true. I felt it myself. On the other hand, our friend Mrs. Conrad is certainly not good at all."
"And her room is over the study," I said musingly and keeping a sharp eye on Poirot. He shook his head with a slight smile.
"No, mon ami, I cannot bring myself seriously to believe that that immaculate lady swarmed down the chimney or let herself down from the balcony."
As he spoke, the door opened, and to my great surprise, Lady Juliet Weardale flitted in.
Monsieur Poirot, she said somewhat breathlessly, can I speak to you alone?
Milady, Captain Hastings is as my other self. You can speak before him as though he were a thing of no account, not there at all. Be seated, I pray you.
She sat down, still keeping her eyes fixed on Poirot.
What I have to say is rather difficult.
You are in charge of this case. If the
papers were to be returned, would that end the matter? I mean, could it be done without questions being asked?
Poirot stared hard at her.
Let me understand you, madame. They are to be placed in my hand, is that right? And I am to return them to Lord Alloway on the condition that he asks no questions as to where I got them?
She bowed her head.
That is what I mean. But I must be sure there will be no publicity.
I do not think Lord Alloway is particularly anxious for publicity, said Poirot grimly.
You accept, then?
She cried eagerly in response.
A little moment, milady. It depends on how soon you can place those papers in my hands.
Almost immediately.
Poirot glanced up at the clock.
How soon exactly?
Say 10 minutes,
she whispered.
I accept, milady.
She hurried from the room. I pursed my mouth up for a whistle.
Can you sum up the situation for me, Hastings?
Bridge, I replied succinctly.
Ah, you remember the careless words of Monsieur the Admiral. What a memory. I felicitate you, Hastings.
We said no more, for Lord Alloway came in and looked inquiringly at Poirot.
Have you any further ideas, Monsieur Poirot? I'm afraid the answers to your questions have been rather disappointing.
Not at all, Milo. They have been quite sufficiently illuminating. It will be unnecessary for me to stay here any longer, and so, with your permission, I will return at once to London.
Lord Alloway seemed dumbfounded.
But what have you discovered? Do you know who took the plans?
Yes, Milor, I do. Tell me, in the case of the papers being returned to you anonymously, you would prosecute no further inquiry?
Lord Alloway stared at him.
Do you mean on payment of a sum of money?
No, Milor. Returned unconditionally.
Well, of course, the recovery of the plans is the great thing, said Lord Alloway slowly.
He still looked puzzled and uncomprehending.
Then I should seriously recommend you to adopt that course. Only you, the Admiral, and your secretary know of the loss. Only they need know of the restitution. And you may count on me to support you in every way. Lay the mystery on my shoulders. You ask me to restore the papers? I have done so. You know no more.
He rose and held out his hand.
Milor, I am glad to have met you. I have faith in you and your devotion to England. You will guide her destinies with a strong, sure hand.
Monsieur Poirot, I swear to you that I will do my best. It may be a fault, or it may be a virtue, but I believe in myself.
So does every great man. Me, I am the same, said Poirot grandiloquently.
The car came round to the door in a few minutes, and Lord Alloway bade us farewell on the steps with renewed cordiality.
That is a great man, Hastings, said Poirot as we drove off. He has brains, resource, power. He is the strong man that England needs to guide her through these difficult days of reconstruction.
Well, I'm quite ready to agree with all you say, Poirot, but what about Lady Juliet? Is she to return the papers straight to Alloway? What will she think when she finds you've gone off without a word?
Hastings, I will ask you a little question. Why, when she was talking with me, did she not hand me the plans then and there?
Well, she hadn't got them with her.
Perfectly. How long would it take her to fetch them from her room, or from any hiding place in the house? You need not answer, I will tell you. Probably about 2 minutes and a half. Yet she asks for 10 minutes. Why? Clearly she has to obtain them from some other person and to reason or argue with that person before they give them up. Now, what person could that be? Not Mrs. Conrad, clearly, but a member of her own family, her husband or son. Which is it likely to be? Leonard Weardale said he went straight to bed. We know that to be untrue. Supposing his mother went to his room and found it empty, supposing she came down filled with a nameless dread... He is no beauty, that son of hers, eh? She does not find him, but later she hears him deny that he ever left his room. She leaps to the conclusion that he is the thief, hence her interview with me. But, mon ami, we know something that Lady Juliet does not. We know that her son could not have been in the study because he was on the stairs making love to the pretty French maid. Although she does not know it, Leonard Weardale has an alibi.
Well, then, who did steal the papers? We seem to have eliminated everybody. Lady Juliet, her son, Mrs. Conrad, the French maid.
Exactly. Use your little grey cells, my friend. The solution stares you in the face.
I shook my head blankly.
Oh, but yes, if you would only persevere. Ah, see then. Fitzroy goes out of the study. He leaves the papers on the desk. A few minutes later, Lord Alloway enters the room, goes to the desk, and the papers are gone. Only two things are possible. Either Fitzroy did not leave the papers on the desk, but put them in his pocket, and that is not reasonable because, as Alloway pointed out, he could have taken a tracing at his own convenience any time. Or else, the papers were still on the desk when Lord Alloway went to it, in which case they went into his pocket.
Lord Alloway, the thief? I said, dumbfounded. But why? Why?
Did you not tell me of some scandal in the past? He was exonerated, you said. But suppose, after all, it had been true. In English, public life, there must be no scandal. If this were raked up and proved against him now, goodbye to his political career. We will suppose that he was being blackmailed, and the price asked was the submarine plans.
But the man's a black traitor, I cried.
Oh, no, he is not. He is clever and resourceful. Supposing, my friend, that he copied those plans, making, for he is a clever engineer, a slight alteration in each part which will render them quite impracticable. He hands the faked plans to the enemy's agent, Mrs. Conrad, I fancy. But in order that no suspicion of their genuineness may arise, the plans must seem to be stolen. He does his best to throw no suspicion on anyone in the house by pretending to see a man leaving the window. But there he ran up against the obstinacy of the Admiral. So his next anxiety is that no suspicion shall fall on Fitzroy.
But this is all guesswork on your part, Poirot, I objected.
It is psychology, mon ami. A man who had handed over the real plans would not be over scrupulous as to who was likely to fall under suspicion. And why was he so anxious that no details of the robbery should be given to Mrs. Conrad? Because he had handed over the faked plans earlier in the evening and did not want her to know that the theft could only have taken place later.
I wonder if you're right, I said.
Of course I am right. I spoke to Alloway as one great man to another, and he understood perfectly. You will see.
One thing is quite certain. On the day when Lord Alloway became Prime Minister, a cheque and a signed photograph arrived. On the photograph were the words, "To my discreet friend, Hercule Poirot," from Alloway. I believe that the Z-type of submarine is causing great exultation in naval circles. They say it will revolutionise modern naval warfare. I've heard that a certain foreign power essayed to construct something of the same kind, and the result was a dismal failure. But I still consider that Poirot was guessing. He will do it once too often one of these days. Problem at sea.
Like a Colonel Clapperton, said General Forbes.
He said this with an effect midway between a snort and a sniff. Miss Ellie Henderson leaned forward, a strand of her soft grey hair blowing across her face. Her eyes, dark and snapping, gleamed with a wicked pleasure. "Such a soldierly-looking man," she said with malicious intent, and smoothed back the lock of hair to await the result.
"Soldierly?"
exploded General Forbes. He tugged at his military moustache and his face became bright red.
"He was in the Guards, wasn't he?"
murmured Miss Henderson, completing her work.
Guards? Guards? Pack of nonsense! Fellow was on the music hall stage! Fact! Joined up and was out in France counting tins of plum and apple. Huns dropped a stray bomb, he went home with a flesh wound in the arm. Somehow or other got into Lady Carrington's hospital.
Oh, so that's how they met.
Fact!
Fellow played the wounded hero. Lady Carrington had no sense and oceans of money. Old Carrington had been in munitions. She'd been a widow only 6 months, and this fellow snaps her up in no time. She wangled him a job at the War Office. Colonel Clapperton. Pah!
He snorted.
And before the war, he was on the music hall stage,
mused Miss Henderson, trying to reconcile the distinguished grey-haired colonel with a red-nosed comedian singing mirth-provoking songs.
Fact, said General Forbes. Heard it from old Bassington French, and he heard it from old Badger Cottrell, who got it from Snooks Parker.
Miss Henderson nodded brightly.
Well, that does seem to settle it, she said.
A fleeting smile showed for a minute on the face of a small man sitting near them. Miss Henderson noticed a smile. She was observant. It had shown appreciation of the irony underlying her last remark, irony which the colonel never for a moment suspected. The general himself did not notice the smiles. He glanced at his watch, rose and remarked,
"Exercise! Got to keep oneself fit on a boat."
And passed out through the open door onto the deck. Miss Henderson glanced at the man who had smiled. It was a well-bred glance, indicating that she was ready to enter into conversation with a fellow traveller.
"He is energetic, yes?" said the little man.
"He goes round the deck 48 times exactly," said Miss Henderson. "What an old gossip! And they say we are the scandal-loving sex. What an impoliteness!"
"Frenchmen are always polite," said Miss Henderson. There was a nuance of a question in her voice. The little man responded promptly.
"Belgian, mademoiselle."
"Oh, Belgian.
Hercule Poirot at your service."
The name aroused some memory. Surely she had heard it before.
"Are you enjoying this trip, Monsieur Poirot?"
"Frankly, no. It was an imbecility to allow myself to be persuaded to come. I detest la mer. Never does it remain tranquil. No, not for a little minute."
"Well, you admit it's quite calm now."
Monsieur Poirot admitted this grudgingly.
"À ce moment, yes. That is why I revive. I once more interest myself in what passes around me. Your very adept handling of the General Forbes, for instance."
"You mean..."
Miss Henderson paused. Hercule Poirot bowed.
"Your methods of extracting the scandalous matter, admirable."
Miss Henderson laughed in an unashamed manner.
"Oh, that touch about the guards. I knew that would bring the old boy up spluttering and gasping."
She leaned forward confidentially.
"I admit I like scandal. The more ill-natured, the better."
Poirot looked thoughtfully at her. Her slim, well-preserved figure, her keen dark eyes, her grey hair. A woman of 45 who was content to look her age. Ellie said abruptly,
"I have it. Aren't you the great detective?"
Poirot bowed.
"You are too amiable, mademoiselle."
But he made no disclaimer.
"How thrilling," said Miss Henderson. "Are you hot on the trail, as they say in books? Have we a criminal secretly in our midst, or am I being indiscreet?"
"Not at all, not at all. It pains me to disappoint your expectations, but I am simply here, like everyone else, to amuse myself."
He said it in such a gloomy voice that Miss Henderson laughed.
"Well, you will be able to get ashore tomorrow at Alexandria. You've been to Egypt before?"
"Never, mademoiselle."
Miss Henderson rose somewhat abruptly.
"I think I shall join the general on his constitutional," she announced.
Poirot sprang politely to his feet. She gave him a little nod and passed onto the deck. A faint, puzzled look showed for a moment in Poirot's eyes. Then, a little smile creasing his lips, he rose, put his head through the door, and glanced down the deck. Miss Henderson was leaning against the rail, talking to a tall, soldierly-looking man. Poirot's smile deepened. He drew himself back into the smoking room with the same exaggerated care with which a tortoise withdraws itself into its shell. For the moment, he had the smoking room to himself, though he rightly conjectured that that would not last long. It did not. Mrs. Clapperton, her carefully waved platinum head protected with a net, her massaged and dieted form dressed in a smart sports suit, came through the door from the bar with the purposeful air of a woman who has always been able to pay top price for anything she needed. She said,
"John? Oh, good morning, Monsieur Poirot. Have you seen John?"
"He is on the starboard deck, madame. Shall I?"
She arrested him with a gesture.
"Now, I'll sit here for a minute."
She sat down in a regal fashion in the chair opposite him. From the distance, she had looked a possible 28. Now, in spite of her exquisitely made-up face, her delicately plucked eyebrows, she looked not her actual 49 years, but a possible 55. Her eyes were a hard, pale blue with tiny pupils.
"I'm sorry not to have seen your dinner last night,"
she said.
"It was just a shade choppy, of course."
"Précisément,"
said Poirot with feeling.
"Luckily, I'm an excellent sailor,"
said Mrs. Clapperton.
"I say luckily, because with my weak heart, seasickness would probably be the death of me."
"Oh, you have the weak heart, madame?"
"Yes, have to be most careful. I must not overtire myself. All the specialists say so."
Mrs. Clapperton had embarked on the, to her, ever-fascinating topic of her health.
"John, poor darling, wears himself out trying to prevent me from doing too much. I live so intensely, if you know what I mean, Monsieur Poirot."
"Oh, yes, yes."
"He always says to me, 'Try to be more of a vegetable, Adeline.' But I can't. Life was meant to be lived, I feel. As a matter of fact, I wore myself out as a girl in the war. My hospital, you've heard of my hospital? Of course, I had nurses and matrons and all that, but I actually ran it."
She sighed.
"Your vitality is marvellous, dear lady,"
said Poirot, with the slightly mechanical air of one responding to his cue. Mrs. Clapperton gave a girlish laugh.
"Everyone tells me how young I am. It's absurd. I never try to pretend I'm a day less than 43.
She continued with slightly mendacious candour.
"But a lot of people find it hard to believe. 'You're so alive, Adeline,' they say to me. But really, Monsieur Poirot, what would one be if one wasn't alive?"
"Dead,"
said Poirot. Mrs. Clapperton frowned. The reply was not to her liking. The man, she decided, was trying to be funny. She got up and said coldly,
"I must find John."
As she stepped through the door, she dropped her handbag. It opened and the contents flew far and wide. Poirot rushed gallantly to the rescue. It was some few minutes before the lipsticks, vanity boxes, cigarette case and lighter and other odds and ends were collected. Mrs. Clapperton thanked him politely, then she swept down the deck and said,
"John!"
Colonel Clapperton was still deep in conversation with Miss Henderson. He swung round and came quickly to meet his wife. He bent over her protectively. Her deck chair, was it in the right place? Wouldn't it be better? His manner was courteous, full of gentle consideration, clearly an adored wife spoilt by an adoring husband. Miss Ellie Henderson looked out at the horizon as though something about it rather disgusted her. Standing in the smoking room door, Poirot looked on. A hoarse, quavering voice behind him said,
"I'd take a hatchet to that woman if I were her husband."
The old gentleman, known disrespectfully among the younger set on board as the grandfather of all the tea planters, had just shuffled in.
"Boy," he called, "get me a whiskey peg."
Poirot stooped to retrieve a torn scrap of notepaper, an overlooked item from the contents of Mrs. Clapperton's bag. Part of a prescription, he noted, containing digitalin. He put it in his pocket, meaning to restore it to Mrs. Clapperton later.
"Yes,"
went on the aged passenger.
"Poisonous woman. I remember a woman like that in Pune. In 87, there was."
Did anyone take a hatchet to her?"
inquired Poirot. The old gentleman shook his head sadly.
Worried her husband into his grave within the year. Clapperton ought to assert himself. Give his wife a head too much."
"She holds the purse strings," said Poirot gravely.
"Ha ha!" chuckled the old gentleman. "You've put the matter in a nutshell. Holds the purse strings. Ha 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 ha!"
Two girls burst into the smoking room. One had a round face with freckles and dark hair streaming out in a windswept confusion. The other had freckles and curly chestnut hair.
"A rescue! A rescue!" cried Kitty Mooney. "Pam and I are going to rescue Colonel Clapperton." "From his wife,"
gasped Pamela Cregan.
"We think he's a pet, and she's just awful. She won't let him do anything,"
the two girls exclaimed.
"And if he isn't with her, he's usually grabbed by the Henderson woman, who's quite nice but terribly old."
They ran out, gasping in between giggles.
"A rescue! A rescue!"
That the rescue of Colonel Clapperton was no isolated sally, but a fixed project, was made clear that same evening when the 18-year-old Pam Cregan came up to Hercule Poirot and murmured,
"Watch us, Monsieur Poirot. He's going to be cut out from under her nose and taken to walk in the moonlight on the boat deck."
It was just at that moment that Colonel Clapperton was saying, "Well, I grant you the price of a Rolls-Royce, but it's practically good for a lifetime. Now, my car..."
"My car, I think, John?"
Mrs. Clapperton's voice was shrill and penetrating. He showed no annoyance at her ungraciousness. Either he was used to it by this time, or else...
"Or else,"
thought Poirot, and let himself speculate.
"Oh, certainly, my dear, your car."
Clapperton bowed to his wife and finished what he'd been saying, perfectly unruffled.
"Voilà ce qu'on appelle le pack à sable,"
thought Poirot.
"But the General Forbes says that Clapperton is no gentleman at all. I wonder now."
There was a suggestion of bridge. Mrs. Clapperton, General Forbes, and a hawk-eyed couple sat down to it. Miss Henderson had excused herself and gone out on deck.
"What about your husband?"
asked General Forbes, hesitating.
"John won't play,"
said Mrs. Clapperton.
"Most tiresome of him."
The four bridge players began shuffling the cards. Pam and Kitty advanced on Colonel Clapperton. Each one took an arm.
"You're coming with us,"
said Pam.
"To the boat deck. There's a moon."
"Oh, don't be foolish, John,"
said Mrs. Clapperton.
"You'll catch a chill."
"Not with us, he won't,"
said Kitty.
"We're hot stuff."
He went with them, laughing. Poirot noticed that Mrs. Clapperton said no bid to her initial bid to two clubs. He strolled out onto the promenade deck. Miss Henderson was standing by the rail. She looked around expectantly as he came to stand beside her, and he saw the drop in her expression. They chatted for a while. Then presently, as he fell silent, she asked, "What are you thinking about?" Poirot replied,
"I am wondering about my knowledge of English. Mrs. Clapperton said John won't play bridge. Is not can't play the usual term?"
"Well, she takes it as a personal insult that he doesn't, I suppose," said Ellie dryly. The man was a fool ever to have married her. In the darkness, Poirot smiled.
"You don't think it's just possible that a marriage may be a success?"
he asked diffidently. "With a woman like that?" Poirot shrugged his shoulders.
"Many odious women have devoted husbands, an enigma of nature. You will admit that nothing she says or does appears to gall him."
Miss Henderson was considering her reply when Mrs. Clapperton's voice floated out through the smoking room window.
"No, I don't think I will play another rubber. So stuffy, I think I'll go up and get some air on the boat deck."
"Good night," said Miss Henderson. "I'm going to bed."
She disappeared abruptly. Poirot strolled forward to the lounge, deserted save for Colonel Clapperton and the two girls. He was doing card tricks for them, and noting the dexterity of his shuffling and handling of the cards, Poirot remembered the General's story of a career on the music hall stage.
"I see you enjoy the cards even though you do not play bridge," he remarked.
"Oh, well, I've my reasons for not playing bridge," said Clapperton, his charming smile breaking out. "Look, I'll show you. We'll play one hand." He dealt the cards rapidly. "Pick up your hands." "Well, what about it?" He laughed at the bewildered expression on Kitty's face. He laid down his hand and the others followed suit. Kitty held the entire club suit, Poirot the hearts, Pam the diamonds, and Colonel Clapperton the spades.
You see, he said, a man who can deal his partner and his adversaries any hand he pleases had better stand aloof from a friendly game. If the luck goes too much his way, ill-natured things might be said.
Oh,
gasped Kitty,
how could you do that? It all looked perfectly ordinary.
The quickness of the hand deceives the eye,
said Poirot sententiously, and caught the sudden change in the Colonel's expression. It was as though he realized that he had been off his guard for a moment or two. Poirot smiled. The conjurer had shown himself through the mask of the Paca Saab. The ship reached Alexandria at dawn the following morning. As Poirot came up from breakfast, he found the two girls all ready to go on shore. They were talking to Colonel Clapperton.
Oh, we ought to get off now, urged Kitty. The passport people will be going off the ship presently. You'll come with us, won't you? You wouldn't let us go ashore all by ourselves. Awful things might happen to us.
Well, I certainly don't think you ought to go by yourselves, said Clapperton, smiling. But I'm not sure my wife feels up to it.
Oh, that's too bad, said Pam. But she can have a nice long rest.
Colonel Clapperton looked a little irresolute. Evidently the desire to play truant was strong upon him. He noticed Poirot.
Oh, hello, Monsieur Poirot. You going ashore?
No, I think not,
Poirot replied.
I'll just have a word with Adeline, decided Colonel Clapperton.
We'll come with you, said Pam.
She flashed a wink at Poirot.
Perhaps we can persuade her to come too,
she added gravely. Colonel Clapperton seemed to welcome this suggestion. He looked decidedly relieved.
Come along then, the pair of you, he said lightly.
They all three went along the passage of B-deck together. Poirot, whose cabin was just opposite the Clappertons, followed them out of curiosity. Colonel Clapperton rapped a little nervously at the cabin door.
Adeline, my dear, are you up?
The sleepy voice of Mrs. Clapperton from within replied,
Oh, Father, what is it?
It's John.
What about going ashore? Certainly not.
The voice was shrill and decisive.
I've had a very bad night. I shall stay in bed most of the day.
Pam nipped in quickly.
Oh, Mrs. Clapperton, I'm so sorry. We did so want you to come with us. Are you sure you're not up to it? I'm quite certain.
Mrs. Clapperton's voice sounded even shriller. The Colonel was turning the door handle without result.
What is it, John? The door's locked. I don't want to be disturbed by the stewards.
Oh, sorry, my dear. Sorry. Just wanted my Baedeker.
Well, you can't have it,
snapped Mrs. Clapperton.
I'm not going to get out of bed. Do go away, John. Let me have a little peace.
Oh, certainly, certainly, my dear.
The Colonel backed away from the door. Pam and Kitty closed in on him.
Well, let's start at once. Thank goodness your hat's on your head. Oh, gracious, your passport isn't in the cabin, is it?
Well, as a matter of fact, it's in my pocket, began the Colonel.
Kitty squeezed his arm.
Glory be, she exclaimed. Now, come on.
Leaning over the rail, Poirot watched the three of them leave the ship. He heard a faint intake of breath beside him and turned to see Miss Henderson. Her eyes were fastened on the three retreating figures.
So they've gone ashore,
she said flatly.
Yes, are you going?
She had a shade hat, he noticed, and a smart bag and shoes. There was a shore-going appearance about her. Nevertheless, after the most infinitesimal of pauses, she shook her head.
No, she said. I think I'll stay on board. I have a lot of letters to write.
She turned and left him. Puffing after his morning tour of 48 rounds of the deck, General Forbes took her place.
Aha!
He exclaimed as his eyes noted the retreating figures of the Colonel and the two girls.
So that's the game, eh? And where's the madam?
Poirot explained that Mrs. Clapperton was having a quiet day in bed.
Ha ha, don't you believe it.
The old warrior closed one knowing eye.
She'll be up for tiffin. And if the poor devil's found to be absent without leave, there'll be ructions.
But the General's prognostications were not fulfilled.
Mrs. Clapperton did not appear at lunch, and by the time the Colonel and his attendant damsels returned to the ship at 4 o'clock, she had not shown herself. Poirot was in his cabin and heard the husband's slightly guilty knock on his cabin door. Heard the knock repeated, the cabin door tried, and finally heard the Colonel's call to a steward.
Look here, I can't get an answer. Have you a key?
Poirot rose quickly from his bunk and came out into the passage. The news went like wildfire round the ship. With horrified incredulity, people heard that Mrs. Clapperton had been found dead in her bunk, a native dagger driven through her heart. A string of amber beads was found on the floor of her cabin. Rumour succeeded rumour. All bead sellers who had been allowed on board that day were being rounded up and questioned. A large sum in cash had disappeared from a drawer in the cabin. The notes had been traced. They had not been traced. Jewellery worth a fortune had been taken. No jewellery had been taken at all. A steward had been arrested and had confessed to the murder. "What is the truth of it all?" demanded Miss Ellie Henderson, waylaying Poirot. Her face was pale and troubled.
"My dear lady, how should I know?"
"Well, of course you know," said Miss Henderson. It was late in the evening. Most people had retired to their cabins. Miss Henderson led Poirot to a couple of deck chairs on the sheltered side of the ship.
"Now tell me," she commanded.
Poirot surveyed her thoughtfully.
"It's an interesting case," he said.
"Is it true that she had some very valuable jewellery stolen?" Poirot shook his head.
"Non, no jewellery was taken. A small amount of loose cash that was in a drawer has disappeared, though."
"I'll never feel safe on a ship again," said Miss Henderson with a shiver. "Any clue as to which of those coffee-coloured brutes did it?"
"Non," said Hercule Poirot. "The whole thing is rather strange."
"What do you mean?" asked Ellie sharply. Poirot spread out his hands.
"Eh bien, take the facts. Mrs. Clapperton had been dead at least 5 hours when she was found. Some money has disappeared. A string of beads was on the floor by her bed. The door was locked and the key was missing. The window, not porthole, gives on the deck and was open."
"Well?" asked the woman impatiently.
"Do you not think it is curious for a murder to be committed under those peculiar circumstances? Remember that the postcard sellers, money changers and bead sellers who are allowed on board are all well known to the police."
"The stewards usually lock your cabin all the same," Ellie pointed out.
"Oh, yes, to prevent any chance of petty pilfering. But this was murder."
"What exactly are you thinking of, Monsieur Poirot?" Her voice sounded a little breathless.
"I am thinking of the locked door."
Miss Henderson considered this.
"Well, I don't see anything in that.
The man left by the door, locked it, and took the key with him, so as to avoid having the murder discovered too soon. Quite intelligent of him, for it wasn't discovered until 4 o'clock in the afternoon."
"Oh, no, no, mademoiselle, you don't appreciate the point I am trying to make. I'm not worried as to how he got out, but as to how he got in."
"Well, the window, of course."
"C'est possible. But it would be a very narrow fit, and there were people passing up and down the deck all the time, remember?"
"Well, then through the door," said Miss Henderson impatiently.
"But you forget, mademoiselle, Mrs. Clapperton had locked the door on the inside. She had done so before Colonel Clapperton left the boat this morning. He actually tried it, so we know that is so."
"Nonsense. It probably stuck, or he didn't turn the handle properly."
"But it does not rest on his word. We actually heard Mrs. Clapperton herself say so."
"We?"
"Miss Mooney, Miss Cragen, Colonel Clapperton, and myself."
Ellie Henderson tapped a neatly shod foot. She did not speak for a moment or two. Then she said in a slightly irritable tone,
"Well, what exactly do you deduce from that? If Mrs. Clapperton could lock the door, she could unlock it too, I suppose."
"Precisely. Precisely."
Poirot turned a beaming face upon her.
"And you see where that leads us. Mrs. Clapperton unlocked the door and let the murderer in. Now, would she be likely to do that for a bead seller?"
Ellie objected.
"Well, she might not have known who it was. He may have knocked,
She got up and opened the door, and he forced his way in and killed her. Poirot shook his head.
Au contraire, she was lying peacefully in bed when she was stabbed.
Miss Henderson stared at him.
What's your idea?
She asked abruptly. Poirot smiled.
Well, it looks, does it not, as though she knew the person she admitted. You mean,
said Miss Henderson, and her voice sounded a little harsh, that the murderer is a passenger on the ship? Poirot nodded.
It seems indicated. And the string of beads left on the floor was a blind? Precisely.
The theft of the money also?
Exactly.
There was a pause. Then Miss Henderson said slowly,
I thought Mrs. Clapperton a very unpleasant woman, and I don't think anyone on board really liked her, but there wasn't anyone who had any reason to kill her. Except her husband, perhaps, said Poirot.
Well, you don't really think... She stopped.
It is the opinion of every person on this ship that Colonel Clapperton would have been quite justified in taking a hatchet to her. That was, I think, the expression used.
Ellie Henderson looked at him, waiting.
But I am bound to say, went on Poirot, that I myself have not noted any signs of exasperation on the good Colonel's part. Also, what is more important, he had an alibi. He was with those two girls all day and did not return to the ship till 4 o'clock. By then, Mrs. Clapperton had been dead many hours.
There was another minute of silence. Ellie Henderson said softly,
But you still think a passenger on the ship?
Poirot bowed his head. Ellie Henderson laughed suddenly, a reckless, defiant laugh.
Your theory may be difficult to prove, Monsieur Poirot. There are a good many passengers on this ship.
Poirot bowed to her.
I will use a phrase from one of your detective stories. I have my methods, Watson.
The following evening, at dinner, every passenger found a typewritten slip by his plate requesting him to be in the main lounge at 8:30. When the company were assembled, the captain stepped onto the raised platform where the orchestra usually played and addressed them. Ladies and gentlemen, you all know the tragedy which took place yesterday. I'm sure you all wish to cooperate in bringing the perpetrator of that foul crime to justice. He paused and cleared his throat. We have on board with us Monsieur Hercule Poirot, who is probably known to you all as a man who has had wide experience in such matters. I hope you will listen carefully to what he has to say. It was at this moment that Colonel Clapperton, who had not been at dinner, came in and sat down next to General Forbes. He looked like a man bewildered by sorrow, not at all like a man conscious of great relief. Either he was a very good actor, or else he had been genuinely fond of his disagreeable wife. Monsieur Hercule Poirot, said the captain, and stepped down. Poirot took his place. He looked comically self-important as he beamed on his audience.
Messieurs, mesdames, he began, it is most kind of you to be so indulgent as to listen to me. Monsieur le Capitaine has told you that I have had a certain experience in these matters. I have, it is true, a little idea of my own about how to get to the bottom of this particular case.
He made a sign, and a steward pushed forward and passed onto him a bulky, shapeless object wrapped in a sheet.
What I am about to do may surprise you a little, Poirot warned them. It may occur to you that I am eccentric, perhaps mad. Nevertheless, I assure you that behind my madness there is, as you English say, a method.
His eyes met those of Miss Henderson for just a minute. He began unwrapping the bulky object.
I have here, messieurs and mesdames, an important witness to the truth of who killed Mrs. Clapperton.
With a deft hand, he whisked away the last enveloping cloth, and the object it concealed was revealed, an almost life-sized wooden doll dressed in a velvet suit and lace collar.
Now, Arthur,
said Poirot, and his voice changed subtly. It was no longer foreign. It had instead a confident English, a slightly cockney inflection.
Can you tell me, I repeat, can you tell me anything at all about the death of Mrs. Clapperton?
The doll's neck oscillated a little. Its wooden lower jaw dropped and wavered, and a shrill, high-pitched woman's voice spoke.
What is it, John? The door's locked. I don't want to be disturbed by the stewards.
There was a cry, an overturned chair. A man stood swaying, his hand to his throat, trying to speak, trying. Then suddenly his figure seemed to crumple up. He pitched headlong. It was Colonel Clapperton. Poirot and the ship's doctor rose from their knees by the prostrate figure. All over, I'm afraid. Heart, said the doctor briefly. Poirot nodded.
The shock of having his trick seen through, he said.
He turned to General Forbes.
It was you, General, who gave me a valuable hint with your mention of the music hall stage. I puzzle, I think, and then it comes to me. Supposing that before the war Clapperton was a ventriloquist. In that case, it would be perfectly possible for three people to hear Mrs. Clapperton speak from inside her cabin when she was already dead.
Ellie Henderson was beside him. Her eyes were dark and full of pain.
Did you know his heart was weak? She asked.
I guessed it. Mrs. Clapperton talked of her own heart being affected, but she struck me as the type of woman who likes to be thought ill. Then I picked up a torn prescription with a very strong dose of digitalin in it. Digitalin is a heart medicine, but it couldn't be Mrs. Clapperton's because digitalin dilates the pupils of the eyes. I had never noticed such a phenomenon with her, but when I looked at his eyes, I saw the signs at once.
Ellie murmured.
So you thought it might end this way?
The best way, don't you think, mademoiselle? He said gently.
He saw the tears rise in her eyes. She said,
But you've known. You've known all along that I cared. But he didn't do it for me. It was those girls' youth. It made him feel his slavery. He wanted to be free before it was too late. Yes, I'm sure that's how it was. When did you guess that it was he?
His self-control was too perfect, said Poirot simply. No matter how galling his wife's conduct, it never seemed to touch him. That meant either that he was so used to it that it no longer stung him, or else, eh bien, I decided on the latter alternative, and I was right. And then there was his insistence on his conjuring ability. The evening before the crime, he pretended to give himself away. But a man like Clapperton doesn't give himself away. There must be a reason. So long as people thought he had been a conjurer, they weren't likely to think of his having been a ventriloquist.
And the voice we heard? Mrs. Clapperton's voice?
One of the stewardesses had a voice not unlike hers. I induced her to hide behind the stage and taught her the words to say.
It was a trick. A cruel trick,
cried out Ellie.
I do not approve of murder, said Hercule Poirot.
How does your garden grow? Hercule Poirot arranged his letters in a neat pile in front of him. He picked up the topmost letter, studied the address for a moment, then neatly slit the back of the envelope with a little paper knife that he kept on the breakfast table for that express purpose, and extracted the contents. The letter was headed Private and Confidential. On the right-hand side was the address, Rosebank, Charman's Green, Bucks, and the date, March the 21st. Dear Monsieur Poirot, I have been recommended to you by an old and valued friend of mine who knows the worry and distress I have been in lately. Not that this friend knows the actual circumstances. Those I have kept entirely to myself, the matter being strictly private. My friend assures me that you are discretion itself, and that there will be no fear of my being involved in a police matter which, if my suspicions should prove correct, I should very much dislike. But it is, of course, possible that I am entirely mistaken. I do not feel myself clear-headed enough nowadays, suffering as I do from insomnia and the result of a severe illness last winter, to investigate things for myself. I have neither the means nor the ability. On the other hand, I must reiterate once more that this is a very delicate family matter, and that for many reasons I may want the whole thing hushed up. If I am once assured of the facts, I can deal with the matter myself and should prefer to do so. I hope that I have made myself clear on this point. If you will undertake this investigation, perhaps you will let me know to the above address. Yours very truly, Amelia Barraby. Poirot read the letter through twice. Again, his eyebrows rose slightly. Then he placed it on one side and proceeded to the next envelope in the pile. At 10 o'clock precisely, he entered the room where Miss Lemon, his confidential secretary, sat awaiting her instructions for the day. Miss Lemon was 48 and of unprepossessing appearance. Her general effect was that of a lot of bones flung together at random. She had a passion for order, and almost equalling that of Poirot himself, and though capable of thinking, she never thought unless told to do so. Poirot handed her Amelia Barraby's letter.
Tell her I will do myself the honour to call upon her at any time she suggests, unless she prefers to consult me here. Do not type the letter, write it by hand.
Yes, Monsieur Poirot. Poirot produced more correspondence.
These are my bills.
Miss Lemon's efficient hands sorted them quickly.
I'll pay all but these two. Why those two? There is no error in them.
No, they're firms you've only just begun to deal with. It looks bad to pay too promptly when you've just opened an account. Looks as though you were working up to get some credit later on.
Ah, murmured Poirot. I bow to your superior knowledge of the British tradesman.
Yes, well, there's nothing much I don't know about them, said Miss Lemon grimly. The letter to Miss Amelia Barraby was duly written and sent, but no reply was forthcoming. Perhaps, thought Hercule Poirot, the old lady had unravelled her mystery herself. Yet he felt a shade of surprise that in that case she should not have written a courteous word to say that his services were no longer required. It was 5 days later when Miss Lemon, after receiving her morning's instructions, said,
"That Miss Barraby we wrote to, no wonder there's been no answer. She's dead."
Hercule Poirot said very softly,
"Ah, dead."
It sounded not so much like a question as an answer. Opening her handbag, Miss Lemon produced a newspaper cutting.
"I saw it in the tube and tore it out."
Just registering in his mind approval of the fact that, though Miss Lemon used the word tore, she had neatly cut the entry out with scissors, Poirot read the announcement taken from the births, deaths and marriages in the Morning Post. On March the 26th, suddenly, at Rosebank, Charman's Green, Amelia Jane Barraby, in her 73rd year. No flowers, by request. Poirot read it over. He murmured under his breath,
"Suddenly."
Then he said briskly,
"If you'll be so obliging as to take a letter, Miss Lemon."
The pencil hovered. Miss Lemon, her mind dwelling on the intricacies of the filing system, took down in rapid and correct shorthand, "Dear Miss Barraby, I have received no reply from you, but as I shall be in the neighbourhood of Charman's Green on Friday, I will call upon you that day and discuss more fully the matter mentioned to me in your letter, yours, etc., etc."
"Type this letter, please, and if it is posted at once, it should get to Charman's Green tonight."
On the following morning, a letter in a black-edged envelope arrived by second post. "Dear Sir, in reply to your letter, my aunt, Miss Barraby, passed away on the 26th. So the matter you speak of is no longer of importance. Yours truly, Mary Delafontaine." Poirot smiled to himself.
"No longer of importance? Ah, that is what we shall see. En avant, to Charman's Green."
Rosebank was a house that seemed likely to live up to its name, which is more than can be said for most houses of its class and character. Hercule Poirot paused as he walked up the path to the front door and looked approvingly at the neatly planned beds on either side of him. Rose trees that promised a good harvest later in the year, and at present daffodils, early tulips, blue hyacinths. The last bed was partly edged with shells.
Poirot murmured to himself, "How does it go? The English rhyme the children sing. Mistress Mary, quite contrary, how does your garden grow? With cockle shells and silver bells and pretty maids all in a row."
No, not a row, perhaps, he considered, but here is at least one pretty maid to make a little rhyme come right.
The front door had opened, and a neat little maid in cap and apron was looking somewhat dubiously at the spectacle of a heavily moustached foreign gentleman talking aloud to himself in the front garden. She was, as Poirot had noted, a very pretty little maid, with round blue eyes and rosy cheeks. Poirot raised his hat with courtesy and addressed her.
"Pardon, but does Miss Amelia Barraby live here?"
The little maid gasped, and her eyes grew rounded.
"Oh, sir, didn't you know? She's dead. Ever so sudden it was, Tuesday night."
She hesitated, divided between two strong instincts. The first, distrust of a foreigner. The second, the pleasurable enjoyment of her class in dwelling on the subject of illness and death.
"You amaze me," said Hercule Poirot, not very truthfully. "I had an appointment with the lady for today. However, I can perhaps see the other lady who lives here."
The little maid seemed slightly doubtful.
"The mistress, well, you could see her, perhaps, but I don't know whether she'll be seeing anyone or not."
"She will see me,"
said Poirot, and handed her a card. The authority of his tone had its effect. The rosy-cheeked maid fell back and ushered Poirot into a sitting room on the right of the hall. Then, card in hand, she departed to summon her mistress. Hercule Poirot looked around him. The room was a perfectly conventional drawing-room, oatmeal-coloured paper with a frieze round the top, indeterminate cretons, rose-coloured cushions and curtains, a good many china knick-knacks and ornaments. There was nothing in the room that stood out that announced a definite personality. Suddenly, Poirot, who was very sensitive, felt eyes watching him. He wheeled round. A girl was standing in the entrance of the French window, a small, sallow girl, with very black hair and suspicious eyes. She came in, and as Poirot made a little bow, she burst out abruptly,
"Why have you come?"
Poirot did not reply. He merely raised his eyebrows.
"Why have you come? You are not a lawyer, no?"
Her English was good, but not for a minute would anyone have taken her to be English.
"Why should I be a lawyer, mademoiselle?"
The girl stared at him sullenly.
"I thought you might be. I thought you had come perhaps to say that she did not know what she was doing. I have heard of such things. The not due influence. That is what they call it, no? But that is not right. She wanted me to have the money, and I shall have it. If it is needful, I shall have a lawyer of my own. The money is mine. She wrote it down. So, and so it shall be."
She looked ugly, her chin thrust out, her eyes gleaming. The door opened, and a tall woman entered and said,
"Katrina?"
The girl shrank, flushed, muttered something, and went out through the window. Poirot turned to face the newcomer, who had so effectually dealt with the situation by uttering a single word. There had been authority in her voice, and contempt, and a shade of well-bred irony. He realized at once that this was the owner of the house, Mary Delafontaine. "Monsieur Poirot, I wrote to you. You cannot have received my letter."
"Oh, alas, I have been away from London."
"Oh, I see. Well, that explains it. I must introduce myself. My name is Delafontaine. This is my husband. Miss Barraby was my aunt." Mr. Delafontaine had entered so quietly that his arrival had passed unnoticed. He was a tall man with grizzled hair and an indeterminate manner. He had a nervous way of fingering his chin. He often looked towards his wife, and it was plain that he expected her to take the lead in any conversation.
"I much regret that I intrude in the midst of your bereavement," said Hercule Poirot.
"Now, I quite realise that it is not your fault," said Mrs. Delafontaine. "My aunt died on Tuesday evening. It was quite unexpected."
"Yes, most unexpected," said Mr. Delafontaine. "Great blow."
His eyes watched the window where the foreign girl had disappeared.
I apologize, said Hercule Poirot, and I withdraw.
He moved a step towards the door.
Half a sec, said Mr. Delafontaine. You, had an appointment with Aunt Amelia, you say?
Parfaitement.
Oh, but perhaps you will tell us about it, said his wife. If there's anything we can do...
No, it was of a private nature, said Poirot. I am a detective,
he added simply. Mr. Delafontaine knocked over a little china figure he was handling. His wife looked puzzled.
A detective? And you had an appointment with Auntie? But how extraordinary.
She stared at him.
Can't you tell us a little more, Monsieur Poirot? It seems quite fantastic.
Poirot was silent for a moment. He chose his words with care.
It is difficult for me, madame, to know what to do.
Look here, said Mr. Delafontaine. She didn't mention Russians, did she?
Russians?
Yes, you know, Bolshies, Reds, all that sort of thing.
Oh, don't be absurd, Henry, said his wife.
Mr. Delafontaine collapsed.
Oh, sorry. I just wondered.
Mary Delafontaine looked frankly at Poirot. Her eyes were very blue, the colour of forget-me-nots. If you can tell us anything, Monsieur Poirot, I should be glad if you would do so. I can assure you that I have a reason for asking. Mr. Delafontaine looked alarmed.
Look, be careful, old girl. You know, there may be nothing in it.
Again, his wife quelled him with a glance.
Well, Monsieur Poirot?
Slowly, gravely, Hercule Poirot shook his head. He shook it with visible regret, but he shook it.
At present, madame, he said, I fear I must say nothing.
He bowed, picked up his hat, and moved to the door. Mary Delafontaine came with him into the hall. On the doorstep he paused and looked at her.
You are fond of your garden, I think, madame.
I? Oh, yes, I spend a lot of time gardening.
Je vous fais mes compliments.
He bowed once more and strode down to the gate. As he passed out of it and turned to the right, he glanced back and registered two impressions, a sallow face watching him from a first-floor window, and a man of erect and soldierly carriage pacing up and down on the opposite side of the street. Hercule Poirot nodded to himself.
Definitivement, he said. There is a mouse in this hole. What move must the cat make now?
His decision took him to the nearest post office. Here he put through a couple of telephone calls. The result seemed to be satisfactory. He bent his steps to Charman's Green Police Station, where he inquired for Inspector Sims. Inspector Sims was a big, burly man with a hearty manner.
Monsieur Poirot? He inquired.
I thought so. I've just this minute had a telephone call through from the Chief Constable about you. He said you'd be dropping in. Come into my office.
The door shut. The inspector waved Poirot to one chair, settled himself in another, and turned a gaze of acute inquiry upon his visitor.
You're very quick to the mark, Mr. Poirot. Come to see us about this Rosebank case almost before we know it is a case. What put you onto it?
Poirot drew out a letter he had received and handed it to the inspector. The latter read it with some interest.
Interesting, he said. The trouble is, it might mean so many things. Pity she couldn't have been a little more explicit. It would have helped us now.
Or there might have been no need for help.
You mean?
She might have been alive.
Oh, you go as far as that, do you? Well, I'm not sure you're wrong.
I pray of you, Inspector, recount to me the facts. I know nothing at all.
Well, that's easily done. Old lady was taken bad after dinner on Tuesday night. Very alarming. Convulsions, spasms, whatnot. They sent for a doctor, and by the time he arrived, she was dead. Idea was she had died of a fit. Well, he didn't much like the look of things. He hemmed and hawed and put it with a bit of soft sawder, but he made it clear that he couldn't give a death certificate. And as far as the family go, that's where the matter stands. They're awaiting the result of the post-mortem. We've got a bit further. The doctor gave us the tip right away. He and the police surgeon did the autopsy together, and the result is in no doubt whatever. The old lady died of a large dose of strychnine.
Aha!
Yeah, that's right. Very nasty bit of work. Point is, who gave it to her? It must have been administered very shortly before death. First idea was it was given to her in her food at dinner, but frankly, that seems to be a washout. They had artichoke soup served from a tureen, fish pie and apple tart. Miss Barraby, Mr. Delafontaine and Mrs. Delafontaine. Miss Barraby had a kind of nurse attendant, a half-Russian girl, but she didn't eat with the family. She had the remains as they came out from the dining room. There's a maid, but it was her night out. She left the soup on the stove and the fish pie in the oven, and the apple tart was cold. All three of them ate the same thing, and apart from that, I don't think you could get strychnine down anyone's throat that way. Stuff's as bitter as gall. The doctor told me you could taste it in a solution of 1 in 1,000 or something like that.
She had money, the old lady?
Well, very well to do, I imagine. Of course, we haven't got exact details yet. The Delafontaines are pretty badly off from what I can make out. The old lady helped with the upkeep of the house. Poirot smiled a little. He said,
So you suspect the Delafontaines? Which of them?
Well, I don't exactly say I suspect either of them in particular. But there it is. They're her only near relatives, and her death brings them a tidy sum of money, I've no doubt. We all know what human nature is.
Sometimes inhuman. Yes, that is very true. And there was nothing else the old lady ate or drank?
Well, as a matter of fact...
Ah, voilà, I felt that you had something, as you say, up your sleeve. The soup, the fish pie, the apple tart, a bêtise. Now we come to the hub of the affair.
Well, I don't know about that. But as a matter of fact, the old girl took a cachet before meals. You know, not a pill or a tablet, one of those rice paper things with powder inside. Some perfectly harmless thing for the digestion.
Admirable. Nothing is easier than to fill a cachet with strychnine and substitute it for one of the others. It slips down the throat with a drink of water and is not tasted.
Yeah, that's all right. Trouble is, the girl gave it to her.
But a Russian girl?
Yes, Katrina Reiger. She was a kind of lady help, nurse companion to Miss Barraby. Fairly ordered about by her too, I gather. Fetch this, fetch that, fetch the other, rub me back, pour out me medicine, run round to the chemist, you know, all that sort of business. You know how it is with these old women. They mean to be kind, but what they need is a sort of black slave. Poirot smiled. And there you are, you see, continued Inspector Sims. It doesn't fit in what you might call nicely. Why should the girl poison her? Miss Barraby dies, and now the girl will be out of a job, and jobs aren't easy to find. She's not trained or anything.
Still, suggested Poirot, if the box of cachets was left about, anyone in the house might have the opportunity.
Well, naturally we're on to that, Monsieur Poirot. I don't mind telling you, we're making our inquiries quiet-like, if you understand me. Such as when the prescription was last made up, where it was usually kept. Patience and a lot of spade work. That's what'll do the trick in the end. And then there's Miss Barraby's solicitor. I'm having an interview with him tomorrow. And the bank manager. There's a lot to be done still.
Poirot rose. A little favour, Inspector Sims. You will send me a little word how the affair matches. I would esteem it a great favour. Here is my telephone number.
Oh, why, certainly, Monsieur Poirot. Two heads are better than one. And besides, you ought to be in on this, having had that letter and all.
You are too amiable, Inspector.
Politely, Poirot shook hands and took his leave. He was called to the telephone on the following afternoon. Is that Monsieur Poirot? Inspector Sims here. Things are beginning to sit up and look pretty in that little matter you and I know of.
In verity? Tell me, I pray of you.
Well, here's item number one, and a pretty big item. Miss B left a small legacy to her niece and everything else to K. In consideration of her great kindness and attention, that's the way it was put, that alters the complexion of things. A picture rose swiftly in Poirot's mind. Sullen face and a passionate voice saying,
The money is mine. She wrote it down, and so it shall be.
The legacy would not come as a surprise to Katrina. She knew about it beforehand. Item number two, continued the voice of Inspector Sims. Nobody but Kay handled that cachet.
You can be sure of that?
Well, the girl herself doesn't deny it. What do you think of that?
Extremely interesting.
We only want one thing more, evidence of how the strychnine came into her possession. Well, that oughtn't to be difficult.
And the young lady, Kay?
I'm detaining her on suspicion. Don't want to run any risks. She might have some funny friends in the country who'd try to get her out of it.
No,
said Poirot.
I do not think she has any friends.
Oh, really? What makes you say that, Monsieur Poirot?
It is just an idea of mine. There were no other items, as you call them?
No, nothing that's strictly relevant. Miss B seems to have been monkeying about a bit with her shares lately. Must have dropped quite a tidy sum. It's rather a funny business one way and another, but I don't see how it affects the main issue. Well, not at present, that is.
No, perhaps you are right.
Well, my best thanks to you. It was most amiable of you to ring me up. Oh, not at all. I'm a man of my word. I could see you were interested. Who knows? You may be able to give me a helping hand before the end.
Oh, that would give me great pleasure. It might help you, for instance, if I could lay my hand on a friend of the girl Katrina.
Well, I thought you said she hadn't got any friends, said Inspector Sims, surprised.
I was wrong, said Hercule Poirot. She has one.
Before the inspector could ask a further question, Poirot had rung off. With a serious face, he wandered into the room where Miss Lemon sat at her typewriter. She raised her hands from the keys at her employer's approach and looked at him inquiringly.
I want you, said Poirot, to figure to yourself a little history.
Miss Lemon dropped her hands into her lap in a resigned manner. She enjoyed typing, paying bills, filing papers, and entering up engagements. To be asked to imagine herself in hypothetical situations bored her very much, but she accepted it as a disagreeable part of duty.
You are a Russian girl, began Poirot.
Yes, said Miss Lemon, looking intensely British.
You are alone and friendless in this country. You have reasons for not wishing to return to Russia. You are employed as a kind of drudge, nurse attendant, and companion to an old lady. You are meek and uncomplaining.
Yes, said Miss Lemon obediently, but entirely failing to see herself being meek to any old lady under the sun.
The old lady takes a fancy to you. She decides to leave her money to you. She tells you so.
Poirot paused. Miss Lemon said,
Yes,
again.
And then the old lady finds out something. Perhaps it is a matter of money. She may find that you have not been honest with her. Or it might be more grave still, a medicine that tasted different, some food that disagreed. Anyway, she begins to suspect you of something, and she writes to a very famous detective, me. I am to call upon her shortly. And then, as you say, the dripping will be in the fire. The great thing is to act quickly. And so, before the great detective arrives, the old lady is dead, and the money comes to you. Tell me, does that seem to you reasonable?
Quite reasonable, said Miss Lemon. Quite reasonable for a Russian, that is. Personally, I should never take a post as a companion. I like my duties clearly defined, and of course, I should not dream of murdering anyone. Poirot sighed.
Oh, how I miss my friend Hastings. He had such an imagination, such a romantic mind. It is true that he always imagined wrong, but that in itself was a guide.
The telephone rang, and Miss Lemon went out of the room to answer it. She came back to say, It's Inspector Sims again. Poirot hurried to the instrument.
Hello? Hello? What is that you say?
Sims repeated his statement.
We found a packet of strychnine in the girl's bedroom, tucked underneath the mattress. The sergeant's just come in with the news. That about clinches it, I think.
Yes, said Poirot. I think that clinches it.
His voice had changed. It rang with sudden confidence. When he had rung off, he sat down at his writing table and arranged the objects on it in a mechanical manner. He murmured to himself,
There was something wrong. I felt it. No, not felt. It must have been something I saw. En avant the little grey cells, ponder, reflect. Was everything logical and in order? The girl, her anxiety about the money. Madame de la Fontaine. Her husband, his suggestion of Russians. Imbecile, but he is an imbecile. The room, the garden. Ah, yes, the garden.
He sat up very stiff. The green light shone in his eyes. He sprang up and went into the adjoining room.
Miss Lemon, will you have the kindness to leave what you are doing and make an investigation for me?
An investigation, Monsieur Poirot? Well, I'm afraid I'm not very good.
Poirot interrupted her.
You said one day that you knew all about tradesmen.
Well, certainly I do, said Miss Lemon with confidence.
Then the matter is simple. You are to go to Charman's Green, and you are to discover a fishmonger.
A fishmonger? Asked Miss Lemon, surprised.
Precisely. The fishmonger who supplied Rosebank with fish. When you have found him, you will ask him a certain question.
He handed her a slip of paper. Miss Lemon took it, noted its contents without interest, then nodded and slipped the lid on her typewriter.
We will go to Charman's Green together, said Poirot. You go to the fishmonger, and I to the police station. It will take us but half an hour from Baker Street.
On arrival at his destination, he was greeted by the surprised Inspector Sims. Well, this is quick work, Monsieur Poirot. I was talking to you on the phone only an hour ago.
I have a request to make to you, that you allow me to see this girl, Katrina... What is her name?
Katrina Reiger? Well, I don't suppose there's any objection to that. The girl, Katrina, looked even more sallow and sullen than ever. Poirot spoke to her very gently.
Mademoiselle, I want you to believe that I am not your enemy. I want you to tell me the truth.
Her eyes snapped defiantly.
I have told you the truth. To everyone I have told the truth. If the old lady was poisoned, it was not I who poisoned her. It is all a mistake. You wish to prevent me having the money.
Her voice was rasping. She looked, he thought, like a miserable little cornered rat.
Tell me about this cachet, mademoiselle,
Monsieur Poirot went on.
Did no one handle it but you? I have said so, have I not? They were made up at the chemist's that afternoon. I brought them back with me in a bag. That was just before supper. I opened the box and gave Miss Barrowby one with a glass of water. No one touched them but you?
No.
A cornered rat with courage.
And Miss Barrowby had for supper only what we have been told? The soup, the fish pie, the tart?
Yes.
A hopeless yes. Dark, smouldering eyes that saw no light anywhere. Poirot patted her shoulder.
Be of good courage, mademoiselle. There may yet be freedom. Yes, and money. A life of ease.
She looked at him suspiciously. As he went out, Sims said to him, I don't quite get what you said through the telephone. Something about the girl having a friend.
She has one. Me,
said Hercule Poirot, and had left the police station before the inspector could pull his wits together. At the Green Cat tea rooms, Miss Lemon did not keep her employer waiting. She went straight to the point. The man's name is Rudge, in the High Street, and you were quite right. A dozen and a half, exactly. I've made a note of what he said. She handed it to him.
Arr.
It was a deep, rich sound, like a purr of a cat. Hercule Poirot betook himself to Rosebank. As he stood in the front garden, the sun setting behind him, Mary Delafontaine came out to him.
Monsieur Poirot?
Her voice sounded surprised. You've come back?
Yes, I have come back.
He paused and then said,
When I first came here, madame, the children's nursery rhyme came into my head. Mistress Mary, quite contrary, how does your garden grow? With cockle shells and silver bells and pretty maids all in a row. Only they are not cockle shells, are they, madame? They are oyster shells.
His hand pointed.
He heard her catch her breath and then stay very still.
Her eyes asked a question. He nodded.
Mais oui, I know. The maid left her dinner ready. She will swear, and Katerina will swear, that he's all you had. Only you and your husband know that you brought back a dozen and a half oysters. A little treat, pour la bonne tante. So easy to put a strychnine in an oyster. It is swallowed comme ça. But there remains the shells. They must not go in the bucket. The maid would see them, and so you thought of making an edging of them to a bed. But there were not enough. The edging is not complete. The effect is bad. It spoils the symmetry of the otherwise charming garden. Those few oyster shells struck an alien note. They displeased my eye on my first visit.
Mary Delafontaine said, I suppose you guessed from the letter?
I knew she had written, but I didn't know how much she had said.
Poirot answered evasively,
I knew at least that it was a family matter. If it had been a question of Katrina, there would have been no point in hushing things up. I understand that you or your husband handled Miss Barrowby's securities to your own profit, and that she found out.
Mary Delafontaine nodded.
We've done it for years, a little here and there. I never realized she was sharp enough to find out. And then I learned she had sent for a detective. And I found out, too, that she was leaving her money to Katrina.
That miserable little creature. And so the strychnine was put in Katrina's bedroom? I comprehend. You save yourself and your husband from what I may discover, and you saddle an innocent child with murder. Had you no pity, madame?
Mary Delafontaine shrugged her shoulders. Her blue forget-me-not eyes looked into Poirot's. He remembered the perfection of her acting the first day he had come and the bungling attempts of her husband. A woman above the average, but inhuman. She said,
Pity? For that miserable, intriguing little rat?
Her contempt rang out. Hercule Poirot said slowly,
I think, madame, that you have cared in your life for two things only. One is your husband,
he saw her lips tremble,
and the other is your garden.
He looked around him. His glance seemed to apologize to the flowers for that which he had done and was about to do. The Market Basing Mystery.
After all, there's nothing like the country, is there?
Said Inspector Japp, breathing in heavily through his nose and out through his mouth in the most approved fashion. Poirot and I applauded the sentiment heartily. It had been the Scotland Yard inspector's idea that we should all go for the weekend to the little country town of Market Basing. When off duty, Japp was an ardent botanist and discoursed upon minute flowers possessed of unbelievably lengthy Latin names, somewhat strangely pronounced, with an enthusiasm even greater than that he gave to his cases.
Nobody knows us, and we know nobody, explained Japp. That's the idea.
This was not to prove quite the case, however, for the local constable happened to have been transferred from a village 15 miles away, where a case of arsenical poisoning had brought him into contact with the Scotland Yard man. However, his delighted recognition of the great man only enhanced Japp's sense of well-being. And as we sat down to breakfast on Sunday morning in the parlour of the village inn, with the sun shining and tendrils of honeysuckle thrusting themselves in at the window, we were all in the best of spirits. The bacon and eggs were excellent, the coffee not so good, but passable and boiling hot.
This is the life, said Japp. When I retire, I shall have a little place in the country, far from crime, like this. A la crime, il est partout, remarked Poirot,
helping himself to a neat square of bread and frowning at a sparrow which had balanced itself impertinently on the windowsill. I quoted lightly, That rabbit has a pleasant face. His private life is a disgrace. I really could not tell to you the awful things that rabbits do.
Lord, said Japp, stretching himself backwards. I believe I can manage another egg and perhaps a rasher or two of bacon. What do you say, Captain?
Oh, I'm with you, I returned heartily. What about you, Poirot? Poirot shook his head.
One must not so replenish the stomach that a brain refuses to function, he remarked.
At that moment, however, an imposing form blocked the doorway. It was Constable Pollard.
I hope you'll excuse me troubling the inspector, gentlemen, but I'll be glad of his advice.
I'm on holiday, said Japp hastily. No work for me. What's the case?
Well, a gentleman up at Lee Hall shot himself through the head.
Well, they will do it, said Japp prosaically. Debt or a woman, I suppose? Sorry, I can't help you, Pollard.
Well, the point is, said the constable, that he can't have shot himself. Leastways, that's what Dr. Giles says.
Jap put down his cup.
Can't have shot himself? What do you mean?
Well, that's what Dr. Giles said, repeated Pollard. He says it's plumb impossible. He's puzzled to death, the door being locked on the inside and the windows bolted, but he sticks to it that the man couldn't have committed suicide.
That settled it. The further supply of bacon and eggs were waved aside, and a few minutes later we were all walking as fast as we could in the direction of Lee House, Jap eagerly questioning the constable. The name of the deceased was Walter Prothero. He was a man of middle age and something of a recluse. He had come to Market Basing 8 years ago and rented Lee House, a rambling, dilapidated old mansion fast falling into ruin. He lived in a corner of it, his wants attended to by a housekeeper whom he had brought with him. Miss Clegg was her name, and she was a very superior woman and highly thought of in the village. Just lately, Mr. Prothero had had visitors staying with him, a Mr. and Mrs. Parker from London. This morning, unable to get a reply when she went to call her master, and finding the door locked, Miss Clegg became alarmed and telephoned for the police and the doctor. Constable Pollard and Dr. Giles had arrived at the same moment. Their united efforts had succeeded in breaking down the oak door of his bedroom. Mr. Prothero was lying on the floor, shot through the head, and the pistol was clasped in his right hand. It looked a clear case of suicide. After examining the body, however, Dr. Giles became clearly perplexed, and finally he drew the constable aside and communicated his perplexities to him, whereupon Pollard had at once thought of Jap. Leaving the doctor in charge, he had hurried down to the inn. By the time the constable's recital was over, we had arrived at Lee House, a big, desolate house surrounded by an unkempt, weed-ridden garden. The front door was open, and we passed at once into the hall, and from there into a small morning room whence proceeded the sound of voices. Four people were in the room. A somewhat flashily dressed man with a shifty, unpleasant face to whom I took an immediate dislike. A woman of much the same type, though handsome in a coarse fashion. Another woman dressed in neat black who stood apart from the rest and whom I took to be the housekeeper, and a tall man dressed in sporting tweeds with a clever, capable face and who was clearly in command of the situation. Dr. Giles, said the constable, this is Detective Inspector Japp of Scotland Yard and his two friends. The doctor greeted us and made us known to Mr. and Mrs. Parker. Then we accompanied him upstairs. Pollard, in obedience to a sign from Japp, remained below, as it were, on guard over the household. The doctor led us upstairs and along a passage. A door was open at the end. Splinters hung from the hinges, and the door itself had crashed to the floor inside the room. We went in. The body was still lying on the floor. Mr. Prothero had been a man of middle age, bearded, with grey hair at the temples. Jap went and knelt by the body.
"Hmph," said Jap.
"Bullet entered the head behind the left ear?"
"Exactly," said the doctor. "Clearly impossible for him to have fired it himself. He'd have had to twist his hand right round his head. It couldn't have been done."
"Yet you found the pistol clasped in his hand? Well, where is it, by the way?"
The doctor nodded to the table.
"Yeah, but it wasn't clasped in his hand," he said. "It was inside the hand, but the fingers weren't closed over it."
"Put there afterwards," said Jap. "That's clear enough." He was examining the weapon. "One cartridge fired."
"We'll test it for fingerprints, but I doubt we'll find any but yours, Dr. Giles. How long has he been dead?"
"Sometime last night. I can't give the time to an hour or so, as those wonderful doctors and detective stories do. Roughly, he's been dead about 12 hours.
So far, Poirot had not made a move of any kind. He had remained by my side, watching Jap at work and listening to his questions. Only from time to time he had sniffed the air very delicately and as if puzzled. I too had sniffed, but could detect nothing to arouse interest. The air seemed perfectly fresh and devoid of odour, and yet from time to time Poirot continued to sniff it dubiously, as though his keener nose detected something I had missed. Now, as Jap moved away from the body, Poirot knelt down by it. He took no interest in the wound. I thought at first that he was examining the fingers of the hand that had held the pistol, but in a minute I saw that it was a handkerchief carried in the coat sleeve that interested him.
Mr. Prothero was dressed in a dark grey lounge suit. Finally, Poirot got up from his knees, but his eyes still strayed back to the handkerchief as though puzzled. The others had raised the door. I realised that they were hunting for the key. They looked in vain.
"Well, that settles it," said Jap. "The window's shut and bolted. The murderer left by the door, locking it and taking the key with him. He thought it would be accepted that Prothero had locked himself in and shot himself, and that the absence of the key would not be noticed. You agree, Monsieur Poirot?"
"I agree, yes. But it would have been simpler and better to slip the key back inside the room under the door. Then it would look as though it had fallen from the lock."
"Ah, well, you can't expect everybody to have the bright ideas that you have. You'd have been a holy terror if you'd taken to crime. Any remarks to make, Monsieur Poirot?"
Poirot, it seemed to me, was somewhat at a loss. He looked around the room and remarked mildly and almost apologetically,
"He smoked a lot, this monsieur."
Well, true enough, the grate was filled with cigarette stubs, as was an ashtray that stood on a small table near the big armchair.
"Well, he must have got through about 20 cigarettes last night," remarked Jap. Stooping down, he examined the contents of the grate carefully, then transferred his attention to the ashtray. "Yeah, they're all the same kind," he announced, "and smoked by the same man. There's nothing there, Monsieur Poirot."
"I did not suggest that there was," murmured my friend.
"Huh," cried Jap. "What's this?"
He pounced on something bright and glittering that lay on the floor near the dead man.
"A broken cufflink. Well, I wonder who this belongs to. Dr. Giles, I'll be obliged if you'd go down and send up the housekeeper.
And what about the Parkers? He's very anxious to leave the house, says he's got urgent business in London."
"Oh, I dare say. It'll have to get on without him. By the way things are going, it's likely that there'll be some urgent business down here for him to attend to. Well, send up the housekeeper and don't let either of the Parkers give you and Pollard the slip. Did any of the household come in here this morning?"
The doctor reflected.
No. They stood outside in the corridor while Pollard and I came in."
"You sure of that?"
"Oh, absolutely certain." The doctor departed on his mission.
"Good man, then," said Jap approvingly. "Some of these sporting doctors are first-class fellows. Well, I wonder who shot this chap. Looks like one of the three in the house. I hardly suspect the housekeeper. She had 8 years to shoot him in if she wanted to. But I wonder who these Parkers are. They're not a prepossessing-looking couple."
Miss Clegg appeared at this juncture. She was a thin, gaunt woman with neat grey hair parted in the middle, very staid and calm in manner. Nevertheless, there was an air of efficiency about her which commanded respect. In answer to Jap's questions, she explained she had been with the dead man for 14 years. He had been a generous and considerate master. She had never seen Mr. and Mrs. Parker until 3 days ago, when they arrived unexpectedly to stay. She was of the opinion that they had asked themselves. The master had certainly not seemed pleased to see them. The cufflinks which Jap showed her had not belonged to Mr. Prothero, she was sure of that. Questioned about the pistol, she said that she believed her master had a weapon of that kind. He kept it locked up. She had seen it once, some years ago, but could not say whether this was the same one. She had heard no shot last night, but that was not surprising, as it was a big, rambling house, and her rooms and those prepared for the Parkers were at the other end of the building. She did not know what time Mr. Prothero had gone to bed. He was still up when she retired at 9:30. It was not his habit to go at once to bed when he went to his room. Usually he would sit up half the night reading and smoking. Oh, he was a great smoker. Then Poirot interposed a question.
"Did your master sleep with his window open or shut as a rule?"
Miss Clegg considered.
"It was usually open, at any rate at the top." "Yet now it is closed. Can you explain that?"
"No, unless he felt a draught and shut it." Jap asked her a few more questions and then dismissed her. Next, he interviewed the Parkers separately. Mrs. Parker was inclined to be hysterical and tearful. Mr. Parker was full of bluster and abuse. He denied that the cufflink was his, but as his wife had previously recognised it, this hardly improved matters for him. And as he had also denied ever having been in Prothero's room, Jap considered that he had sufficient evidence to apply for a warrant. Leaving Pollard in charge, Jap bustled back to the village and got into telephonic communication with headquarters. Poirot and I strolled back to the inn. "You're unusually quiet," I said. Doesn't the case interest you?
Au contraire, it interests me enormously. But it puzzles me also.
Well, the motive is obscure, I said thoughtfully. But I'm certain that Parker's a bad lot. The case against him seems pretty clear, but for the lack of motive, and that may come out later.
Nothing struck you as being especially significant, although overlooked by Jap?
I looked at him curiously. What have you got up your sleeve, Poirot?
What did the dead man have up his sleeve?
Oh, that handkerchief.
Exactly, that handkerchief.
Well, a sailor carries his handkerchief in his sleeve, I said thoughtfully.
Ah, an excellent point, Hastings, though not the one I had in mind.
Anything else?
Yes. Over and over again, I go back to the smell of cigarette smoke.
I didn't smell any, I cried wonderingly.
No more did I, cher ami.
I looked earnestly at him. It's so difficult to know when Poirot is pulling one's leg. But he seemed thoroughly in earnest and was frowning to himself. The inquest took place 2 days later. In the meantime, other evidence had come to light. A tramp had admitted that he had climbed over the wall into the Lee House garden, where he often slept in a shed that was left unlocked. He declared that at 12 o'clock he had heard two men quarrelling loudly in a room on the first floor. One was demanding a sum of money, the other was angrily refusing. Concealed behind a bush, he had seen the two men as they passed and repassed the lighted window. One he knew well as being Mr. Protheroe, the owner of the house, the other he identified positively as Mr. Parker. It was clear now that the Parkers had come to Lee House to blackmail Protheroe, and when later it was discovered that the dead man's real name was Wendover, and that he had been a lieutenant in the Navy and had been concerned in the blowing up of the first-class cruiser Merrythought in 1910, the case seemed to be rapidly clearing. It was supposed that Parker, cognizant of the part Wendover had played, had tracked him down and demanded hush money, which the other refused to pay. In the course of the quarrel, Wendover drew his revolver and Parker snatched it from him and shot him, subsequently endeavouring to give it the appearance of suicide. Parker was committed for trial, reserving his defence. We had attended the police court proceedings. As we left, Poirot nodded his head.
It must be so, he murmured to himself. Yes, it must be so. I will delay no longer.
He went to the post office and wrote off a note which he dispatched by special messenger. I did not see to whom it was addressed. Then we returned to the inn where we had stayed on that memorable weekend. Poirot was restless, going to and from the window.
I await a visitor, he explained. It cannot be. Surely it cannot be that I am mistaken.
No.
Here she is.
To my utter astonishment, in another minute, Miss Clegg walked into the room. She was less calm than usual and was breathing hard as though she had been running. I saw the fear in her eyes as she looked at Poirot.
Sit down, mademoiselle, he said kindly. I guessed rightly, did I not?
For answer, she burst into tears.
Why did you do it? Asked Poirot gently. Why?
I loved him so, she answered. I was nursemaid to him when he was a little boy. Oh, be merciful to me.
I will do all I can. But you understand that I cannot permit an innocent man to hang, even though he is an unpleasing scoundrel.
She sat up and said in a low voice,
perhaps in the end I could not have either. Do whatever must be done.
Then, rising, she hurried from the room.
Did she shoot him?
I asked, utterly bewildered. Poirot smiled and shook his head.
He shot himself. Do you remember that he carried his handkerchief in his right sleeve? That showed me that he was left-handed. Fearing exposure after his stormy interview with Monsieur Parker, he shot himself. In the morning, Miss Clegg came to call him as usual and found him lying dead. As she has just told us, she had known him from a little boy upwards, and was filled with fury against the Parkers who had driven him to this shameful death. She regarded them as murderers, and then suddenly she saw a chance of making them suffer for the deed they had inspired. She alone knew that he was left-handed. She changed the pistol to his right hand, closed and bolted the window, dropped the bit of cufflink she had picked up in one of the downstairs rooms, and went out locking the door and removing the key.
"Poirot," I said in a burst of enthusiasm, "you are magnificent. All that from the one little clue of the handkerchief
and the cigarette smoke. If the window had been closed and all those cigarettes smoked, the room ought to have been full of stale tobacco. Instead, it was perfectly fresh. So I deduced at once that the window must have been open all the night and only closed in the morning, and that gave me a very interesting line of speculation. I could conceive of no circumstances under which a murderer could want to shut a window. It would be to his advantage to leave it open and pretend that the murderer had escaped that way, if the theory of suicide did not go down. Of course, the tramp's evidence, when I heard it, confirmed my suspicions. He could never have overheard that conversation unless the window had been open."
"Splendid," I said heartily. "Now, what about some tea?"
Spoken like a true Englishman, said Poirot with a sigh. I suppose it is not likely that I could obtain here a glass of syrup.
We hope you've enjoyed listening to this HarperCollins audiobook.
Audible hopes you've enjoyed this programme.